This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome, one and all, however many of you there are, to another edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. I'm Greg Phillips, here in our luxurious, hard-traveling homestead of Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Joined as always by my partner in crime, my partner in life, Nick Duke. Nick, how are you today?
I'm doing well. Judging by your speech patterns, you're ready to get into the rundown tonight, where we're going to talk about a certain actor you seem to have modeled the open of this show after.
I don't know which actor you're referring to.
Now, Greg, let's be honest. You know, I'm no voice man, but I know that you have some vocal talent. And let's be honest with each other. That wasn't your best Shatner. Let's just call a spade.
I was just using the vocal pattern. Mm-hmm. I wasn't doing the impression.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hope later on in the show you can provide our listening audience with a bit higher quality.
Well, quite frankly, maybe I will and maybe I won't. We'll see when we get to it. But in the meantime, we do have a wonderful show for everyone today, hopefully. We've got a countdown of our top five Walking Dead characters, and we will be joined by a veritable Walking Dead expert herself, Jennifer Smith, one of the co-hosts of Geek and Sassy right here on Place to Be Nation Pop. That's coming up a little bit later on. But let's get things started. We often do here on the longest running
weekly episodic comic book podcast in Place to Be Nation Pop history.
Mm. And that, of course, is what you're reading, what you're watching.
Still without a jingle after all these weeks.
I have a little bit of insider information about that.
Oh, are you about to tell tales out of school?
I am about to tell tales out of school. I received a message yesterday from the anonymous Raw General Manager.
What about the anonymous Place to Be Nation Pop General Manager?
I didn't hear from him or
well,
her.
What the hell good does that do us?
Well, the anonymous Raw General Manager is looking for work right now. So he,
see, and I was under the impression he was going to be competing in WLC 2 coming up at the House of Hardcore.
WLC. Oh, that's great. No, I'm not claiming to know the identity of the Raw General Manager. In fact, from
Greg,
the
that identity was publicly revealed.
I don't believe that reveal. I choose not to believe that reveal. Because the way that this General Manager wrote his email to me in a certain speech pattern, with certain words emphasized differently than the normal human being, would make.
Are you suggesting that the anonymous Raw General Manager may or may not have some personality characteristics, you know, in common with one Jimmy Olsen from the comics, specifically from the Silver Age?
I am suggesting that, and may have an aggressive hatred of James Olsen.
Well, that could be anybody. That could be anybody on Place to Be Nation Pop. That could be any male member of Place to Be Nation Pop, Greg. And you know this.
The message I received indicated that we may soon come into possession of a jingle that has been recorded.
Mm-mm.
Now, I don't know. I'm not
That's
making
gonna
any
That's
going to
be some
promises.
Mighty fine a picking and a singing.
That's right. I'm not making any promises. I'm just saying that I've received a message, and that's all I can say about it. But
now,
sadly,
what I want to know is, did he get $10 to sing into the can?
We ain't one at a time in here, Nick. We mass communicating.
Ah, yes. Yes.
Very good. And now here on the Papio Daniel Flower Hour.
I was about to say the Papio Daniel Podcast Hour.
We gonna talk to you live and in public about the top three books and the bottom book.
Bottom one.
Bottom one book.
Off to a rip-roaring start already this evening.
Of the time period that we're covering here, which for me is a little bit longer because I still haven't fully caught up to modern day comics. I'm very, very close. I'm closer than I've been in months, but I'm not there yet. I'm just not there yet. Now, get us started this week, Nick, with your number three book of the week.
It's got to be me, huh? All right. Well,
I start out every week.
No, that's fine. That's fine, Greg. That's fine. My number three book of the week, The Invincible Iron Man, number 14, the series finale for this incarnation of The Invincible Iron Man. Greg, we talked last week about a few books that made our top three a week ago, and we said, man, we love us some books that's all just characters sitting around having a conversation. Well, that's exactly what this is. This is Tony Stark in the middle of, you know, the Civil War II conflict. The stresses of leading a side in this conflict are getting to him, and he feels the urge to drink. And so rather than drinking, he seeks out an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And it just so happens that he attends the same AA meeting as Captain Marvel, Carol Danvers. And they have a conversation that takes up most of the issue outside this AA meeting, where they pretty much hash out not just the conflict here, but kind of their entire relationship going back to when they first met. They kind of explain to each other why they're acting the way they are, and they each make impassioned pleas to the other to just stand down. You can see that these two characters are extremely stubborn. Neither is going to see the light, you know, neither is going to come over to the other side, and that at the end of the conversation, they are just as divided, if not more divided, than they were going into it. But it's an entirely dialogue-driven issue. It is what Brian Michael Bendis excels at. It does end on a cliffhanger where with a flash forward where Tony Stark is no longer in the picture. So luckily, you know, Civil War II was delayed a good bit. I was concerned that this was going to give some stuff away, but this does not give away the ending of Civil War II. We know that Tony Stark will not be in the armor at the conclusion of that event, but we do not know how just yet. So looking forward to seeing how that goes. But mainly I just want to give this book a big shout out because very rarely do you see the very serious topic of alcohol addiction dealt with in such a sensitive manner and dealt with in such a realistic manner. This feels like an actual conversation between two people who have real substance abuse problems. I don't know if Bendis has perhaps been through that in his life to provide that, you know, that realistic slant on it, but I for one love this issue. And have really, really enjoyed this entire Invincible Iron Man run. Will not be picking up either of Bendis' two Iron Man titles going forward, but I will be checking both out on Marvel Unlimited and can't wait for those to hit that service at some point.
Very good. Sounds intriguing and interesting. I'm curious to read Bendis' Iron Man one day in trade form, perhaps. I find a lot of modern comics read better in trade, and it seems like this might be one of those books that will when the time comes.
I think so, especially, you know, because the last three or four issues have been tied up in Civil War II stuff. So if I had to imagine, they'll probably split it into three trades because there were two story arcs before Civil War II started. And so I think, especially if you read the first two, that way you wouldn't necessarily have to read this one because I really feel like you can't read this story arc without also reading Civil War II because you need to understand what's going on in that title, I think.
Very good. My number three book of this particular time period that I've read in the last couple weeks, or week or so, I guess, would be Batman Detective Comics number 940. This is and are we good with giving spoilers? Did we already spoil this before, Nick? I think we might have.
I mean, it's been a few weeks. I think we gotta. So we'll just say it now. Spoilers. I think I know where you're going. So go ahead.
Spoiler alert, everyone. This is your opportunity to skip ahead probably about 3 or 4 minutes in the recording. Maybe not even that long. But this is the issue of Detective Comics in which Tim Drake, Red Robin, is taken off the board, so to speak, from Detective Comics. It is seemingly the death – it's basically a death of Tim Drake issue that doesn't actually have a death in it.
Right.
Just a perceived death. Everyone thinks that he's dead except for him. He's taken away at the end by a mysterious figure who has also been popping up throughout Action Comics and a few other books. So, you know, you get the basically the death of Tim Drake. All the other Robins have essentially had their death issues, I suppose. So Tim finally gets his, and I will admit, I wasn't expecting to like this issue very much because, as you know, Nick, I've been critical of this concept of another Batman sidekick seemingly killed and Batman grieving again. But I'll say this, the execution was marvelous on this book.
It really was. Even the character of Spoiler, who I'm higher on than you are, I think even you will admit the ending of this book kind of got
yes.
got you caring about that character a little bit.
I'll tell you, the panels that really got me were the panels when she hands the letter to Bruce, the letter that Tim was accepted to the college he was trying to get into, and that shot of Bruce's hands trembling. As he drops the note.
Yep.
Really, really, really good work by Eddie Barrows in this issue, the artist.
And then the embraces, you see the tears streaming mm-hmm. down both of their faces. I thought that was powerful stuff.
It was, and you just – anybody that's read Batman for a long time – this felt like a book or a comic for long-time Batman fans, because if you've read A Death in the Family, if you've read Nightfall, if you've read Hush, if you've read the Morrison story where Damian dies and the follow-up issues in the other Batman books – that sense of dread that I got in my gut when I was reading the issue and reading how Batman is reacting to it, Batman knows. He knows very early in the issue what's going to happen. And it's that not again kind of mentality that really got to me. So I really can't say enough good things about this issue. James Tynion IV did a wonderful job. Eddie Barrows did a wonderful job, and this continues to be the best Batman book on the stands.
I completely agree. So moving on to my number two book of the week, I've got Green Arrow number 8. This is the first issue of the Island of Scars storyline, and this issue is basically Oliver Queen and the Black Canary stranded on a desert island, and that's the concept. They are forced to confront some of their feelings for each other. They have, you know, confronted those feelings in a physical manner previously in the series, but they have not really confronted those feelings in an emotional manner before. And you kind of get the idea of, you know, what their differences are still and, you know, what they have to work on to make their relationship work. But you also get more – I mean, that's one thing I'll say about this series. Even some of the issues that have been not as good as others, I think the highlight has been Ben Percy's basic understanding of what makes that relationship go, and his ability to write the characters in a believable manner, to write romantic chemistry between the two in a fantastic way, and that just shines through here. It makes you really just want to read a book mm-hmm. that's nothing but those two characters sitting around talking to each other. I mean, it's electric every time we get it, and this issue is pretty much nothing but that. So I absolutely love this issue. Big bounce back after the Sins of the Mother story, two-parter, that I didn't enjoy quite as much. So Green Arrow number 8, back on my list at the number 2 spot. Can't wait to see what else happens here in this Island of Scars story.
Yeah, this is another series that continues to bring its star character back to the forefront. I mean, this is a version of Oliver Queen that longtime DC fans will recognize. It's a version of Dinah Lance that long-term DC fans will recognize. And it does. It feels like it's sparking a resurgence in the character and sparking a resurgence in, you know, I guess the romance side of the DC universe, which got neglected for quite a long time. So very good stuff. Looking forward to reading that when I get around to it. My number two book of the week is a book that I had heard praise from you and Russell, heard some mixed reaction from other people. I finally read it. I thought it was excellent, and that is Trinity Number One.
Oh, I absolutely loved it.
Story, dialogue, pencils, inks, colors, all done by Francis Manapul. When you buy this comic, there is only one name on the cover, and I can't remember the last time I saw that. It's the entire, at least in a DC or Marvel book, it is the love child of Francis Manapul, and it is wonderful. And the love is a good word to describe it, because love pours into each and every page of this book. It's wonderful from beginning to end. And particularly the usage of Jonathan, Superman's son. John is great in here, as he is in seemingly every appearance that he has in the DC Universe now. He's great. But he's so good here as that kind of unifying force that draws Wonder Woman, Batman, and Superman back together and creates this bond, even though that they don't know this version of Superman. This is the pre-Flashpoint Superman. They instinctively know that there's a connection there, or certainly Wonder Woman senses it, and Batman, I think, senses it too, although he's want to admit it. There's some really great, funny dialogue. I laughed out loud at least twice at some of Batman's dialogue. The entire story of Batman's rainbow suit, folks, that's all I'll say. You have to read that. And then at the end, they're standing by a fence post, and Wonder Woman is philosophizing about what it means for all of them to be together. Maybe it's about more than just defeating the villains of this world. And then there's a beat, and then it cuts to Batman, and he just goes, doubtful. So just a wonderful book that is a great launching pad. Also, Lois Lane. I love Lois Lane. You know that, Nick. Everybody that listens here knows how much I love Lois as a character and how much I didn't like her in the New 52. This is Lois Lane. This is Lois written correctly, written right, with lots of heart and love poured onto the page. Big fan of this book.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, I knew what to expect from an art standpoint, but I wasn't overly familiar with Manapul as a writer, and I was blown away by his dialogue. I thought it was – he has outstanding characterizations of not just the Trinity, but Lois as well. Lois is almost like the fourth lead of the book in mm-hmm. in that issue, and I really like that as well. Moving on, you know, here to my number one book of the week. Greg, sometimes – you know, when we do this, it's a very agonizing choice as to what we're going to go with in our top spot. And this mm-hmm. was not one of those weeks for me. This was a clear-cut, blow-away, just an almost flawless issue in my opinion. And I think it's something that you probably saw coming, and I think it's something that anybody who knows my taste, my biases, saw coming ever since this series was announced that it was going to be making its return. But my number one book of the week, Jessica
Squirrel
Jones.
Girl number two.
Jessica Jones, number one. From Brian Michael Bendis and Michael Gatiss. I don't even know where to begin, man. Like, as I told you off air, so to speak, as I told you when we were discussing the bullshit politics in the back, it's almost like I can envision in my head Brian Michael Bendis just sitting down and going, let's see, what are all the things that Nick Duke loves about my work, and just balling them into one comic. It's snippy, quippy dialogue. It's, you know, it is a borderline misanthropic character in Jessica Jones. It's a book where seemingly every character in it is absolutely miserable. It's a book that contains a subplot about the freaking Ultimate Universe, apparently. It's everything I love about Brian Michael Bendis' work rolled into one comic. I cannot recommend this highly enough. And what's great about it is there is an actual mystery that you're intrigued by, that you want to know what's going on. The art is absolutely amazing, putting the old team of Bendis and Gatiss back together. Nobody writes Jessica Jones the way Brian Michael Bendis writes her, and nobody draws her the way Michael Gatiss does. I absolutely loved this issue. I cannot wait to see where all the subplots are going, whether it's the main, you know, the main story of, not to spoil things too much, but something has happened between Jessica and Luke. We are not told what. They are estranged when this book opens, and I am highly intrigued to see what the story there is.
That's interesting because typically you're not a big fan of the split 'em up story arcs.
Ah, I said estranged. I didn't say split. You know, there is a central conflict here, a believable central conflict. And if I know these characters the way I know them, especially the way Bendis writes them, there will be a believable reason for this conflict. I have faith in him when it comes to these two characters. And then, of course, like I said, the Ultimate Universe subplot, where basically Jessica's new client, the gimmick of it is that she wants Jessica to investigate her husband because her husband keeps having visions of another life he lived. And the lady shows Jessica on her tablet, like, how she had been looking up crazy conspiracies online where people were claiming to have visions of another universe. And it actually showed a little piece of art on the page from one of the Ultimate Universe stories. And it was just, oh, man, it was everything I could hope for a book. I'm so glad Jessica Jones is back. And one thing I was extremely worried about was that in the current climate, it would not feel like the old Alias title, that they would have to make some kind of tonal shift to be not quite as abrasive and a little bit more kid friendly. While there's no sex in uncomfortable places in the opening issue, I will say that the tone and especially the dialogue on Jessica's part is not pulling any punches from the get go. So if you like the character Jessica Jones, if you enjoyed the Netflix series, go out and pick this one up. It is already probably one of my favorite books in comics, and that's after one issue. And yes, that's hypocritical, and I don't care.
There you have it. No surprise. I knew you'd like that one. One of your favorite titles from back in the day was Alias. So yep. Makes sense that you would enjoy this one. Now, for my number one, also an easy choice for me this time around, although I love Trinity and I love Detective Comics and a few other ones that I'll mention in quick hits.
I
don't think you do.
I think I do.
This is a book that in the last podcast – I said was the most unexpectedly funny book of Rebirth.
Oh wow.
It came out in its third issue and had another funny issue that also was very, very poignant and very cool and very different, and that is Deathstroke number 3. This is a book that from an artistic standpoint and from a writing standpoint is, in my opinion, one of the best books of Rebirth yet, single issues. This is Slade Wilson, at this point, has been made aware of a hit that has been put out on his daughter, Rose, his estranged daughter, Rose, a.k.a. Ravager. He doesn't know who put the hit out, but somebody on the dark web has put a hit on his daughter, and some of the most nasty assassins, basically, are taking the hit. And so he decides to take the hit just to go and basically figure out who's doing it. So he goes and he tracks Rose down. And this entire issue is examining Slade and Slade's family. And this whole arc, actually, the professional, has dealt with Slade's family. But this is really showing you his and Rose's relationship and why they're estranged and why some of the reasons why Slade is the cold-hearted asshole that he is, which he's always been cold, he's always been an asshole, but this shows you just some of the things that have happened to make him the way he is, some of the horrible things that happens. This retells the story, modernizes the story of how Slade lost his eye, which is really, really tragic and caught me off guard, really shocked me, the scene. It's a flashback scene when it happens. This also introduces a really cool power that Ravager has that is illustrated perfectly by the colorist Jeremy Cox, where Ravager has the ability to see a few moments into the future when there's danger, basically. And she's not an assassin, but she actually has a job where she stops assassinations, basically. She takes out contracts to stop other assassins. And she tracks these guys down to this park, these would-be assassins, and it actually threw me off because it looks like she gets killed. but it's done in black and white, and that's a flash forward that she has to tell her how not to proceed. And so it allows her to kind of go about the whole scenario differently and end up saving her own life in the process. So that's cool. But the crux of the issue, the main event, if you will, of the issue, is a rooftop conversation between Slade and Rose, where they kind of what you would typically expect to be a bonding moment between them. And Rose proceeds to kind of sit there, and she's bashing Slade the whole time. And then she sits there and she explains that Slade had walked in on her with her boyfriend on the couch, and she explains to Slade that without him asking, she said, "I'm not actually screwing him, you know. We're just, it's only sleeping. It's about owning your sexuality, not giving it away." She basically like gives this big philosophical spiel, and yet you felt compelled to tell me for some reason, which means you're wanting to tear Rose down, and it's one of the greatest sequences of tearing down a character that I've seen in comics this year, because Rose is, of course, a teenager in this, and she says, you keep saying I'm not ready. I was trained by Nightwing, and he goes, the prosecution rests. He says, you watch TV, you smoke dope, you party with your clueless friends, every day is spring break. You work at a strip club, but blue ball your fella, spouting some postmodern Faustian BS philosophy you make up as you go. Like every other empty-headed nitwit teenager, you're too immature to know how stupid you are. Honestly, Rose, I'd take you more seriously if I thought you actually believed in something. I can't say enough about this book right now. Christopher Priest is delivering a Deathstroke book that I knew could be this good.
It's high praise, sir. High praise. So I guess we should move on to our bottom books, huh?
Yep.
Well, quite frankly, I'm not going to give you a bottom one. I'm not going to do it. I'm going to cheat this week.
What do you mean? You can't do that.
I'm giving you a bottom two. And let me tell you.
Can I lend my one to you?
No. Let me tell you why I'm giving you a bottom two. Because this week, there were two installments of Night of the Monster Men released, and I just can't pick one over the other. That's why I'm going with a co-bottom one of Batman number 8 and Nightwing number 6. Now, I will say this. These two parts were better than the first three parts, but that's not saying much. Continues to be an exceedingly average comic with exceedingly average execution of exceedingly average concepts. Nothing at all to write home about here. The only cool scene in the entire book was a scene in which Batman encases himself inside Clayface to battle one of the monsters. Other than that, not worth it. Skip it. Nothing important going on here. And that's all I have to say about Batman number 8 and Nightwing number 6.
Let me ask you this. You mentioned it's about a bunch of monsters they're fighting, right?
Yes.
At any point, does the monster abyss show up?
Sadly, no. Sadly, there's no abyss, there's no Rosemary, and of course, there is no Crazy Steve.
Crazy Steve. He who defies the laws of grammar, because he's so crazy.
He's crazy.
Very interesting. Now, but we've been a little straight-laced in recent weeks. We've been a little by the books in recent weeks. I think it's time to get a little controversial, Nick.
Oh. Yes?
Are you okay with being just a little bit controversial?
I can handle it. What's going on?
Because I preface it. Let me preface it by saying this. As I will give this the usual disclaimer that I've given many times and that you've given many times. This was a time period this past week I did not read a bad comic book. Not one. I didn't even read an average comic.
I know where you're going with this, and I
above average comics.
And quite frankly, I don't appreciate the sentiment.
My bottom book of this time period.
Don't say it.
Is All-Star Batman number 1?
Absolutely not. There's no way.
Yep. Yep. Not because it's bad. Not because it's not a good comic book, because it is. It's good.
Oh, my God. Here we go. Here we go, people. If there's nothing you... No, wait, before you even say it, if there's one thing that all you listeners out there need to know about Greg Phillips, this man is as cheap as they come. So go ahead, Greg.
This comic book was $4.99. If you're selling me a single-issue comic for $4.99, it better not just knock my socks off, it better leave me needing a smoke in the morning. That's how good it needs to be.
Which is to say, Greg never will never buy a Marvel number one ever again.
No. I only got Captain America number one because I don't even remember why I got that. I got that one and I don't remember why or how, but I don't believe I paid full price for it. I'll put it that way. This is a fine comic book, but it's way too expensive. And quite honestly, in addition to being too expensive, it's not that good. It really isn't. It's okay. It's fine. You know, I'm not, as you know, Nick and I diverge on John Romita Jr. I am not a big John Romita Jr. guy. Never have been.
I will say that I think I like Romita Jr., but I do not think he is the best fit for Batman. But I understand
he's a better fit for Batman than he is for Superman, though.
I don't know. I think, but I understand the idea. The idea was, I mean, to make it all-star Batman was to put, you know, two superstar creators out there, out front on Ford. I mean, and I know you're not as big on Romita, but I think you understand the buzz his name brings.
Absolutely, and I respect the fact that he's got a loyal fan base. Some of our friends are big fans of him. David's a big fan of Romita Jr., but for me, I don't know. I'm not a big fan, and honestly, this first issue was kind of boring to me. Like, I thought the backup was significantly better than the main feature. The backup with Duke and Batman, and they find the woman that's got all the cuts all over her. Part of that is because I'm a big Zazz fan. Which is not to be confused with a jazz fan, which I also am. But, it's Killer Moth and Firefly, you know, not the most compelling villains in the world, but they serve their purpose here. But just, you know, I don't know. I'm just – again, it's not bad, but I asked myself, is this worth investing the equivalent of almost the equivalent of two other comics a month in? And the answer to that is no. So this will not make my pull list. It will not get back on my pull list. I will read it in trade when it comes out because I love Scott Snyder. But this is my bottom book of the week, controversial though it may be.
Your money-grubbing ways will come back to haunt you, Greg Phillips, as I told you they would.
Well, you did tell me. You did tell me that they would.
Let's go ahead and why don't we share that story with the people, Greg? Who told you? Who told you not to throw away one of your favorite collections of one of your favorite stories, all in pursuit of the almighty dollar? Who said, "Don't do it, Greg. You'll regret it, Greg. Don't do it, Greg."
You told me, and I felt I needed money because I was having trouble. I was low on funds. I felt I needed, you know, for those that don't know, the Infinite Crisis Omnibus, which we have, if I'm not mistaken, Nick, we reviewed at one point. When we were doing the column, and maybe I'm wrong on that, but I thought we did. Anyway, it's my favorite collection of stories, and in any event, I thought I needed to get some money, and that Infinite Crisis Omnibus is listed for over $1,000 on Amazon, and on eBay has been regularly selling for around the $400 range. So I sold the book, and I got a hefty sum for it, and I thought all was well. I went to the post office. I got it packaged by the postal worker, sent it off. Well, didn't hear from the person I sold it to for, you know, some time, and was just waiting on my money to become available. Money became available, but then I got a message indicating that with photos that the United States Postal Service – had destroyed the book in the shipping process. It had water damage all over it. The hardcover was bent. And so I didn't know how to proceed. I've never sold a book online, never sold anything online, in fact. So I sent the guy a message. I said, well, how do we do this? I did have insurance on the package. I paid for the insurance on the package, but I didn't know how to proceed. And he didn't respond to me for a week, but finally got back to me today indicating that, you know, he wants his money back, which I get, and he's going to send me the book. And he said to file a claim with USPS, and that'll be fine. Well, that's all well and good, but I have to do that whole process, and I'm worried it's going to become a massive debacle. And, you know, yeah, basically, Nick's right. I'm being punished for betraying my values and trying to sell a priceless heirloom.
Absolutely. And one day you will come to regret this as well, Greg. I have a feeling. Here's my official prediction, Greg. You want to know my official prediction?
Not really.
All-Star Batman is going to wind up being the comic book version of John Cena and Shawn Michaels.
Oh, here we go.
Going for an hour on Monday Night Raw.
We're going on almost 10 years. You realize, Nick, that April will mark 10 years of you giving me crap for that. 10 years.
Well, quite frankly, did you or did you not miss John Cena and Shawn Michaels going an hour on Monday Night Raw?
At the time that it aired, I missed it. Yes, I have subsequently watched it.
Yep, but you didn't get that live viewing experience, did you?
No, I didn't. I had my reasons at the time.
Yeah, and they were bad reasons then, just like your money-grubbing ways are bad reasons now.
Well, quite frankly, that's your opinion. Shall we do our quick hits?
I suppose. You go first.
I'll go first on my quick hits.
Are we exchanging or just going to do them all in a row?
Let's exchange.
Okay, I've only got three. Four. One.
I've got four.
Okay, there we go. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I've got three as well.
Go ahead.
I had a wrong book in there. Okay, so Wonder Woman, number five, is the continuing part of the story The Lies by Greg Rucka and Liam Sharp. Another stellar issue of Wonder Woman. The plot continues to move forward and thicken. Cheetah continues to be a really compelling character on here. This issue also introduced us to who I assume is Sasha Bordeaux, who, to my knowledge, Nick, correct me if I'm wrong, yes, she is a Greg Rucka creation, but she has not, to my knowledge, been seen since the New 52 began. If you remember this character, by the way, Nick, I don't know if you do or not, she was invented in Rucka and Brubaker's Batman run as a bodyguard for Bruce Wayne. She later became, of course, an agent of, what was that group called?
Oh, she became the White Queen of Checkmate or whatever.
Of Checkmate. The White Queen of Checkmate, yep. And
or the Black Queen or the White Queen, whatever one of those queens.
The Black Queen, I think. She became the leader of Checkmate in the OMAC book and the OMAC project and all that stuff. So she has not been seen since then, and this also introduced a really interesting idea that she's being controlled by someone. Now, whether that is supposed to be a new version of Brother Eye or whether that is supposed to have something to do with Ozymandias or Dr. Manhattan, I don't know. But it was certainly interesting. So I'm looking forward to seeing where that goes.
Awesome. I've got Green Lanterns number 8, continuing the Family Matters storyline. And like I said last week, you want to see more of the Simon Baz and Jessica Cruz dynamic? This is the storyline for you. This is these two spending some downtime with Simon Baz's family on Halloween, while also kicking off what appears to be the plot involving the Phantom Ring. I think you'll really enjoy this when you get to it. To be honest, I've enjoyed the last two issues that have been mostly dialogue-driven more than I enjoyed any of the opening Red Lantern storyline arcs. Or storyline issues, I should say. So, yeah, Green Lantern's number 8.
Very good. I've got, and I'll hit both of these at the same time because it's the same title, Aquaman 6 and 7. Continuing the tremendous Dan Abnett run on Aquaman here in Rebirth. The issue number 6, of course, probably got the most attention because this is a knockdown, drag-out fight pitting Aquaman and Mira versus Superman. And it's really good. It's really fun. Arthur has been pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed. And even though Superman is trying to do the right thing and trying to be diplomatic, Arthur's pretty much had enough, and he's not going to take any more BS from anybody. So he and Mira are fighting back with all they've got against Superman, and they give him a what for a little bit there, especially Mira. She lays it on Superman a few times, and that's pretty good. But then at the end, they don't. And what I love about this is they beat up on Superman a little bit in the issue, but the Abnett makes it clear through the dialogue that Superman's holding back, to the point where even at the end of it, he issues a warning to Arthur and lets him go. And Arthur explains to Mira that basically they're in deep shit now, essentially. So that they better fix this, or else they're going to deal with a non-holding back Superman. So really good stuff. Really great issue. Mira is one of the best characters in all of DC Comics. Aquaman's awesome. The Black Manta takeover of Nemo, which you see more in 7, is intriguing. Great series.
Awesome. To piggyback on that, Aquaman number 8 begins the new Unstoppable storyline that sees Black Manta fully in control of Nemo. Very much enjoying this. Did not quite make my top 3, but still, as you said, Aquaman continues to have great momentum moving forward.
And is that all your quick hits?
No, I've got one more.
All right.
Superman number 8 begins the Escape from Dinosaur Island storyline. While I can already tell I'm probably not going to enjoy this story as much as I did the one that preceded it, it is a tonal tribute to the life and work of one Darwin Cook, and for that alone, I can appreciate what they're going for.
I'm curious, before we move on to the rundown, what was the book you thought was going to be my number one?
I thought you were going to say Superman number 7. I thought you would have finally read that one.
I haven't read it yet, but there are reasons why I haven't. I got shorted a book in Superman number 6, so I don't want to move to 7 yet. So did you like the Darwin Cook issue?
I liked it fine. I liked it well enough. You know, Dinosaur Island is not one of my favorite concepts out there, but, you know, it's fine.
Well, let's move on to the always popular, always ignored rundown segment. And this is where we talk about...
Are we going to do our watching segment?
Oh, I forgot about watching. Yep. Lord Almighty. Well, we've got a watching segment, folks. If you've got about another 2 hours to sit down and listen to us tell you what we've been watching.
There's a lot on television. Greg is flustered. Greg, you need to calm down, sir. You know,
there's a lot on television right now, Nick. There's a lot on television. There's a lot that has been watched in the last week by us.
Listen to me. If the Geek and Sassy people and the Sellers Point people can do 4-hour podcasts, we can go a little longer than our normal format. We'll still be coming in well under them, Greg, so don't worry about it. Don't worry about it as much.
Well, that notwithstanding, quite frankly.
Those podcasts are the Peter Jackson of podcasts. They can't do anything that's under 3 hours. You know, us, we're the Chris Nolan of podcasts. We approach that 3-hour mark, but the quality is just so much higher.
I would suggest that perhaps we're more of the Ernest P. Worrell of podcasts.
Well, that's just that good.
We're popular for reasons that aren't entirely clear. But
why was he popular?
I loved him. I don't know why though.
Women loved him.
Southerners loved him. He gave us a glimpse into our own lives.
So in place of this week's watching segment, we're going to discuss now Ernest Saves Christmas.
We're going to rank the Ernest series. Oh, man. Anyway, but in all seriousness, we do have a lot of things we've been watching. Last week was, of course, the premiere of Arrow and The Flash on the CW. Nick has been working through last season of Supergirl, correct?
I finished it.
Oh, you finished it? You finished last season of Supergirl, and he's been working through Daredevil season 2 a little bit. I have completed Daredevil season 2. What else did I feel like I watched something else. I watched a marathon of Arrow season 2 a little bit over the weekend with Russell. And so we just got a lot to go. Where should we start, man?
Oh, let's see. Let's go. let's start with the oldest thing and work our way forward. I don't really feel like we need to discuss Arrow Season 2 unless you want to discuss it very briefly.
I just wanted to say I think it might be my favorite season of live-action comic book television.
You know, I caught a little bit of Season 3 in the same marathon, I think the next day, and I was stunned by how much I was enjoying Season 3, which I remember, you know, you and I were both higher on.
Yep.
But I would classify it as a step below season two, so I can't imagine how season two would hold up.
Yep,
you know, for me
well.
Going back and revisiting it. Season two is the best episode, the best season of any CW DC show thus far. And yes, that includes The Flash. I understand that some people believe Flash came in and took over from, you know, from the jump, but I'm an Arrow season two guy through and through. So, moving forward from that, I guess we could talk about Supergirl, which I finally watched the season finale. You know, I talked last week about how much how surprised I was to find that I enjoyed that show in season one. It improved as it went along, but I will say I did not enjoy the season finale as much as I did the five or six episodes leading into it. I understand that the show is trying to be a brighter, more hopeful, more optimistic show and give you a more hopeful tone and take on the superhero
genre. Right,
there it is. Thank you. But I gotta say, Kara breaking everyone out of mind control by giving a speech on television was one of the cheesiest, corniest things that show did all season, and that's saying something. So less of that, please. Also, the fight scene, the big Kara and Martian Manhunter against Indigo and non-fight. Last was way too short for a season-ending brawl, although it did give me lobotomized Non, so high hopes for bringing that character back as a mute. So yeah, it did not stick the landing, but I'm going to stand by my statement from last week that I still think it was the second best of the DC on television shows last year, just behind The Flash, ahead of Legends of Tomorrow, ahead of Arrow, which had its worst season of the show thus far. And, of course, 1,000 miles ahead of
hashtag Gotham sucks.
So, Supergirl, you know, I was able to finish that up leading into this week's season premiere of Supergirl Season 2. Have you had a chance to watch that one yet?
No, not yet.
Okay, I'll keep my thoughts on that very brief then. Enjoyed this episode. There is a particular relationship involving a particular character who has nothing to do with his comic book counterpart that it would appear is already being thrown by the wayside, and I'm hoping that's not just a red herring or a CW special of will they or won't they. I'm hoping that we can lay that one to rest, hopefully, but we will discuss this one more in depth.
You might say that it's a red-headed herring.
A red-headed herring, indeed. We will discuss this one more, you know, once you've had a chance to see it, but I for one, am officially predicting that you will love the way Superman is handled in this season premiere, because, yes, this does mark the official introduction of Superman onto the show.
Yes.
And so, I guess, what else? Daredevil Season 2, I'll touch on that real briefly.
Just very, very briefly,
yeah. You know, Greg, you've given your thoughts on it, you know, ad nauseum, quite frankly.
Ad nauseum?
Your criticisms of Karen Page, your criticisms of...
I have been very brief in my comments on Daredevil on this show.
Maybe I'm carrying over, you know, maybe I'm working a work and I don't know that it's a shoot or some shit or whatever. However that goes. In any event, I, through six episodes, am still very much enjoying this season. There hasn't really been much I haven't enjoyed, to be honest. I love Elektra. I love pretty much everything that's going on. So I am still waiting to see these perceived character missteps and this crying that you insist goes on. I'm still waiting for that to pop up.
Curiouser and curiouser.
Well, quite frankly.
Let's move on to the mutually watched CW premieres of last week. Let's start off with Tuesday, which was the premiere of Flash, The Flash, that is, on CW Network. Season 3 premiere of that show, which hit the ground running with Flashpoint right out of the gates. I thought that this was a really good premiere episode, really strong, that was stolen by 1980s Ric Flair version of Cisco Ramon, which is a character that needs to stick around or at least pop up from time to time, because it was awesome. Because apparently Flashpoint Cisco, he's rich, but for some reason, instead of dressing like a 2016 rich person, he dresses like a 1980s rich person.
He dresses awesome. Like Patrick Bateman.
Yes, like Patrick Bateman. And it's awesome.
Yes, it is.
It is absolutely amazing.
That, I think, is my biggest, like, I liked pretty much everything about the differences between the Flashpoint universe and the regular universe. And that's the one thing that I wish was sticking around. And I think, you know, since we say sticking around, I guess we better just address that elephant in the room. And, you know, spoilers once again, but Flashpoint appears to already be over. Greg, did you see that coming?
No, I thought that it would be – I didn't think it would last the whole season.
Nor did I.
I thought it would last up until the midway point, maybe. Like maybe 6 or 7 episodes.
Right.
Or up until, you know, the holiday break and everything, and that would be the conclusion. But I was stunned to see Barry reverse course reverse course on this issue so quickly. So that was a shocker for sure, but it's interesting to see, and you know, it to me, it kind of further illustrates the issues that I had with Barry's characterization in terms of it kind of feels like Barry's learned this lesson before, and now he's learning it again.
He had to relearn it, apparently. Yeah, you and I both had issues with that decision at the end of season two. No matter how cool it was in terms of, you know, the potential to see Flashpoint adapted, I think we just had issues from a characterization standpoint. Although I was glad to see it didn't take him very long to realize the error of his ways. And that's one thing I want to say is, you know, we have not really spent a whole lot of time on this show with the true Reverse Flash. Most of the time when we've dealt with the Reverse Flash, it's been him under the guise of Harrison Wells. So I believe what's the actor's name? Matt Lechner, is that correct?
I don't know, to be honest. I'd have to pull it up.
This was really his first extended run as Reverse Flash on the show, and I thought he was outstanding, dude.
Yeah.
It was
the scene where he forces Barry to tell him that he wants him to kill his mother again.
Yeah, the gimmick of the episode is that Barry has been holding him captive since he returned. And so basically throughout the episode he plays the Hannibal Lecter to the Flash's Clarice Starling, and it's outstanding, man. Absolutely loved it. I also loved
Delightfully Evil.
Delightfully Evil. I loved their take on Joe. I loved the new take on Iris. I loved pretty much everything about the Flashpoint universe. And the one thing that we did learn was there are some lasting consequences from Barry's decision, because it would appear that even though he's back in his normal timeline, not everything is as he left it, because apparently in the altered, you know, normal timeline, so to speak, Joe and Iris don't have a relationship, apparently. So that's an interesting change, and I'm intrigued to see what they do with that going forward.
And interestingly, also in the altered universe that Barry created, Gotham no longer sucks.
That is a feat too large for even time space manipulation, sir.
In any event, let's move on to Arrow, which had its season 5 premiere.
Indeed.
5 seasons. Wow. Pretty remarkable in and of itself. But it had its 5th season premiere on Wednesday night. And if anybody follows me on Twitter, at gphillips8652, you would know that I loved this episode. This was a especially after having watched the season 2 episodes that I did over the weekend, this felt like a return to form. Let's start off with the checklist. Villain who is just a menacing guy and has no supernatural powers, check. Oliver on his own fighting crime for most of the episode, check. Oliver struggling to balance a dual identity, check.
Captain Lance being unnecessarily gruff.
Yes, having a perpetual stubble on his face, check. Oliver having flashbacks that actually mean something, that actually tie into the theme of the episode and inform his decisions in the present day, check. And this, by the way, was the best change from last season.
Yes.
The flashbacks were wonderful. They brought back a character, a fan favorite character in Anatoly, who was in the earliest episodes of Arrow. He's great, and these flashbacks actually show you why things are happening in the present day, and a return after what, with some exceptions here and there, what was a pretty weak season in terms of action for Arrow, in terms of fight scenes. This, I don't know if they got a new choreographer in or brought back an old choreographer, but the fight scenes in this episode were brutal. They were hard-hitting, they were violent, they were bloody. This felt like what made Arrow make its mark, so to speak, in season one. So I have very high hopes for this. The tone was back to what I want the tone of Arrow to be, I think. And I was, for the record, and yes, people can find record of me saying this, I was excited when they were changing the tone a couple seasons ago, and I enjoyed season three, but I thought the tone and the lack of direction in season four really hurt it.
You know, I was fine with the idea of the tonal shift as well, but I think they swung too far, you know, and you have to find that balance, and that's one thing they didn't do. I pretty much echo everything you just said. I love this episode. However, I, you know, for the interest of generating discussion, I will play devil's advocate here for a moment. And I agree with all the things. Go fuck yourself. I'll agree with all the things you said that were good. But here, let me highlight a few concerns I have. And I'll start with the biggest concern first. If we are going to criticize Barry Allen for going back and saving his mom as being a step backward for the character, I don't see any way we can sit here and not have the same criticism of Oliver Queen killing people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
that's fair.
I mean, I don't know how you felt about it. I have issues with that, especially because they didn't even seek to explain it, in my opinion. Perhaps that's something that will be explored over the course of the season. I certainly hope it's something that will be explored. I need a believable reason for that to be the case, because otherwise it just felt like a cheap hitting of a reset button that you hadn't built to.
Well, I think they did try to explain it, whether you buy the explanation as another story or his explanation is that if he had killed Damian Dark earlier, that nothing that happened to Laura would have happened, although Thea instantly calls him out on that line of logic.
Right.
But I will say I'm okay with it because I think that I can overlook that character misstep if it means that we're going back to a different tone in a different direction. Because honestly, Ollie is a character that, in my opinion anyway, the absolute no-kill policy might not make the most sense for if you're doing a grounded approach for him. Because he shoots arrows at people.
Right, and I'm not saying a no-kill policy, but I'm also his
not just killing without regard.
And it felt a little bit too much like that in this episode. Also, and you know, granted, I hope that I'm proven wrong about this, but I made the comparison to you off the air that this idea of the new team coming in feels a lot like Lost in the middle seasons. If for those of you who watch that show, I think you'll all remember that at a certain point, they kept expanding the cast and expanding the cast. And every time they expanded the cast, you would just say to yourself, I don't really care about these characters. I just want to know about my season one characters and what they're doing. And I am concerned that I'm going to be sitting here watching characters like Wild Dog, Vigilante, Artemis, and some version of Mr. Terrific, and wondering, well, what the hell's going on with Diggle and Thea and Felicity? You know, I'm going to give them a chance, but skeptical would be the best word to use about this team shift.
Two other quick points on Arrow, and then we'll move along. I had issues even last season with how big they made the cast. I think that as the team has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, it has taken some of the attention away from Oliver, and that's something that they need to refocus on this year, is reminding us that this is all, at the end of the day, this is a show about Oliver Queen. So I'm with you on that. I have some concerns about that, but I'm hoping that'll be one of the stories that is told over the course of the season, is that, you know, maybe Oliver's starting to realize, maybe the others will realize that perhaps Oliver was right.
Absolutely.
And the other thing I want to say is, at some point this season, whoever that guy was at the end of the episode with Felicity needs to take an arrow.
To the throat.
Yep.
Absolutely. Real quick, I already know the answer to this, but let's state our official opinion. Episode of the week for you.
Arrow.
I'm going Flash myself.
And there you have it. Well, with that being said, let's move along to the rundown. Won't spend too much time on this, but we do have some news and notes for you around the comic book world. First of all, we finally have some information about Wolverine 3, which is coming up next year and purports to be Hugh Jackman's last turn in his iconic role as Wolverine. And they have made some casting announcements. They've made some character announcements. They have issued some posters, one of which in particular Nick is fond of. But this
I don't believe that's a poster. I think that's just an image.
I hope it's a poster. this is a movie that's coming up pretty soon, and it's amazing that we really haven't heard anything about it to this point. Like, no spoilers about what the plot is or anything like that.
Right.
We do know that the famous X-Men enemy, Donald Pierce, who leads the Reavers, was also a member of the Hellfire Club, but presumably he'll be in the Reavers here, is going to be one of the villains in the movie. He has been cast as some fellow named Boyd Holbrook, who I don't know who that is, but he's been cast. And also they finally confirmed that, reportedly confirmed that X-23 is going to be in the movie. And from the images that have been coming out, it certainly looks as if this is going to be at least a version of Old Man Logan. I mean,
in as much as it will feature an Old Man Logan, I don't think it's going to have anything to do with the original story, though. Like, incestuous Hulks, no blind Hawkeye, none of that.
Right. And apparently the movie is going to be set in 2024, and it says mutant births are severely in decline. People aren't sure why. There's a government operation that is turning mutant children into killing machines, and Jackman ends up mentoring a young girl who has two claws instead of his three, which is X-23, obviously.
Yep.
Now, what I really like about this is there is a leaked page of a script by James Mangold, and he is pretty
pretty clear about what the tone of this thing is going to be.
Pretty clear about what the tone is. The quote in the script is, "If you're looking for a gravity-defying, city-block-destroying CG F-a-thon, this ain't your movie." He makes it clear that when people are hit, they are going to be hurt. If something falls on someone, they will be smashed. If someone is hit by a car, they will be killed. It is a violent script, it looks like, and that's exactly what I want from my Wolverine movie. So, absolutely. Really excited about this.
Absolutely. I will say I loved the teaser poster they put out that had that shows Wolverine's extended hand with claws popped, holding the hand of a small child who we would assume to be X-23. And even though that's X-23, that does have a lot of callbacks. It harkens back to that original Old Man Logan story, you know, where his love for a child or to a couple of children played so heavily into that story. So that's a positive note. And then as Greg alluded to, one of the things that's in this movie that I can't wait for is even older Professor Xavier. And yes, Patrick Stewart was a little bit older in the X-Men movies already, but this Professor Xavier looks like he could die at any moment. He's covered in liver spots. You can practically see hair growing out of his ears. He looks a lot like the grandpa from Hey Arnold is the best way I can describe it. He looks ancient, and I can't wait. And apparently he's going to be dealing with memory loss, which is actually, like, not even – all jokes aside, that's a really intriguing concept for somebody with the powers of Charles Xavier and the power level that he has. You know, somebody who has all that power who could forget himself and not realize what he's doing with it. So I'm pumped, man. And to go ahead and confirm, even though it's a ways down the road, when that movie comes out in March, we will be marking its release with a very special Wolverine month, where all of our episodes that month will be Wolverine themed.
Indeed, so, and you know, and I will just say that it does beg the question: who is older, Charles Xavier in that poster, or Aunt May as drawn by Steve Ditko?
Aunt May as drawn. Yeah, that's a good question. And you know, it's at times like these that we need Todd Weber and a little guitar riff for, you know, a certain version of a certain song by Kansas. But that's neither here nor there.
Neither here nor there. Nick, we've also got some announcements coming out of New York Comic Con about DC Rebirth Wave 2. Tell the folks what we got out of that one.
So we already knew that Justice League of America, as we discussed last week, would be part of the second wave of Rebirth titles. We also knew that Super Sons was going to be part of that wave of Rebirth titles. What we didn't know about Super Sons was the creative team. And they have finally confirmed that in a stroke of genius, in the opinions of myself and Greg, Pete Tomasi, who's been writing Superman and writing the character of John Smith / John Kent as well, he will be writing this book. And the art will be done by Jorge Jimenez. I think you and I are both very excited for this. I think we're both going to give it a shot. The characters of Damian and John should make for some very interesting interactions going forward. And then also another book that was announced, and I think this is a fantastic move by DC. We have both, you know, spoken at length about our love for what they've done with Detective Comics, and one of the bright spots of Detective Comics, something we've both agreed on, is it's made us care about the character of Batwoman in ways we never knew possible. And, you know, capitalizing on that in a big bad way, DC was able to announce a forthcoming Batwoman solo ongoing title to be written by Marguerite Bennett. I can't remember who's on art on that one. Steve Epting is going to be on art with Marguerite Bennett doing the writing. So, and what's even greater is they're not just going to launch it, you know, out of nowhere. They're actually going to build to it. There's going to be a two-part Detective comic story that will set up what her solo book is going to be about. So very excited for those two books to be joining, you know, the Rebirth initiative.
Yes, absolutely. Very, very exciting news. Very, very exciting. I'm really excited about Super Sons. Batwoman should be really good. The art is the biggest draw for me there. Very excited to see Epting at DC. From that, we got a cartoon announcement that I know you're really excited about, Nick. Ultimate Spider-Man.
Let's take us. This is, you know, this really was the roller coaster of emotions for me when reading the news sites this week. So, Greg, I want you to tell the people, you know, the first, you know, there's three pieces of news here, and I will react in kind.
Ultimate Spider-Man is coming to an end.
Finally, thank God. That train wreck abortion of a show that has bastardized the name of Ultimate Spider-Man is ending. I don't know if you ever watched Ultimate Spider-Man, but it's one of the biggest pieces of shit that ever existed. They promised us, Greg, all those years ago, they said, we're doing a Spider-Man show. We're doing Ultimate Spider-Man. Brian Michael Bendis is going to be involved. We're going to directly adapt stories from the Ultimate Universe. And he's also going to write some new stories. And guess what else? Paul Dini's going to be involved. How could it suck, Greg? How could it suck? And then it sucked. It was one of the worst things ever with their stupid Family Guy-style cutaways that ruin the show. Ruin the show. Characters that we don't give a damn about. I'm sorry. I don't need to watch teenage White Tiger and Nova and other crappy characters running around with Spider-Man. I don't need Superhero Academy. Just give me my damn Ultimate Spider-Man show, you bastards.
Very well. And then from there, we got another announcement. A brand new Spider-Man show will be debuting at some point in 2017 to offer a, quote, fresh take on the titular character. And it will be headed up by Robot Chicken's Kevin Shinnick and Avengers Assemble's Phil Pignotti.
And promised a, quote, back to basics approach.
Approach.
Hey, I think Avengers Assemble sucks. I don't know much about Robot Chicken, but it's got to be better than Ultimate Spider-Man. And that back to basics approach, that sounds good to me. My mind is open. I'm willing to give it a shot at this point.
And finally, the icing on the cake, the coup de grace, if you will, to quote the legendary Dusty Rhodes, the American Dream, just announced longtime amazing Spider-Man writer Dan Slott will act as a consulting producer on the project.
Fuck this show. I want Ultimate Spider-Man back.
And with that, that brings an end to that news item. We got two more left for you, folks. First of all, a big casting announcement in the Marvel Cinematic Universe Netflix area. And that is that the primary villain of the Defenders will not be a character that's already been introduced. It will be a character played by legendary actress Sigourney Weaver. Ripley herself will be playing a role in the Marvel Cinematic Universe on Netflix. Defenders, of course, is supposed to hit in the fall of 2017 after Iron Fist and the Punisher. And they haven't revealed who she plays or what her character name is, but Sigourney Weaver is going to be there, and she's certainly one of the most accomplished actresses to get a role on the – probably the most accomplished actress to get a role on the Netflix – in the Netflix universe.
I would argue the most accomplished actor or actress to get a role on any of the Marvel television shows. This is a huge get for Marvel as far as I'm concerned, especially for the Netflix, the Netflix shows, which have – you know, they've all been critically beloved, but I think most people consider them to be somewhat niche. You know, they're not on cable television. They're not seen by a vast majority of people, even though they are seen by a lot of Netflix subscribers, and they do very well in that regard. I was taken aback by this news. Very surprising they were able to get that, to get her on a Netflix budget, and I can't wait to see what her role winds up being. You know, we've all been led to believe that the Hand are going to be the main villains in The Defenders, and I'm not aware of any female Hand characters, especially any female white Hand characters. So I wouldn't be surprised if she winds up playing a version of Typhoid Mary or something like that. Or who knows? It could be an entirely new creation for the show.
She could be playing Gonorrhea Mary.
Good Lord. And of course, the only person who can beat gonorrhea, Ric Flair. So moving on. But yeah, I think it's a great get, and I'm sure you probably feel the same way.
Yes, absolutely. Booyaka. Boo. Yaka. Booyaka. Boo. Ya. Ka. 619.
Much better, sir. Much better.
Bill Shatner. Old Bill Shatner. William Shatner has been cast as Two-Face, ladies and gentlemen, on the upcoming animated sequel to a movie that hasn't even released yet, Batman Return of the Caped Crusaders.
That's right. Freaking Bill Shatner. Freaking Billy Shatner as Two-Face. This is going to be amazing. So what I want to happen here, Greg, with this news, is I want Russell Sellers and I want Kelly Poole to go to their printers, and I want them to print this story off from Newsarama. You know, print it off, read it, and then I want them to take that story. I want them to ball it up real nice. I want them to turn that some bitch sideways and stick it straight up their anti-Batman 66 candy asses. This is going to be awesome.
Oh, a fiddler on the roof. That sounds crazy, no? Going to be awesome. Can't wait. Looking forward to it. Bill Shatner and comic books. I mean, is there a better fit? I don't think so. I mean, this is going to be tremendous. And perhaps they'll revisit Batman 66 on a future episode of Sellers Points and talk about some of the good side of this classic show with its egg-based villains. that's another thing. They need to have Egghead in the next one, too.
Excellent. But who's going to do the Vincent Price impersonation?
Oh, man. Bill Hader.
Ooh, that's actually pretty good. Damn it, Greg. Stop getting my hopes up for an entire series of. But you know, this makes sense, though. They really do. If they're going to sequelize this, they've got to crank him out as fast as they can, because you got to figure Adam West or Burt Ward, one of them is going to drop dead at any moment, right?
Yeah, hopefully not. Let's knock on wood about that, but.
Especially Burt Ward, because you got to think, after all those years of having his genitalia squeezed into those shorts, they're probably approaching his lungs at this point, and I would figure that's going to cause some kind of obstruction.
Oh, Lord. Good Lord. You kidding me? In any event, we're going to take a break, ladies and gentlemen, and when we come back, finally, we're going to get to Countdown with Jenny Smith of Geek and Sassy. Really excited to have her on here. This will be her second appearance on the Hard Traveling Fanboys. So stay tuned. Don't you dare go away.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you're subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Just head to iTunes today. and search and subscribe to the Place to Be podcast feed, the PWO PTBN feed, PTBN Pop, and of course, the Kevin Kelly Show feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Some really great stuff. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. Thanks for being a fan of professional wrestling. More importantly, thanks for being a fan and supporter of the Place to Be Nation.
Place to Be Nation is JT Rizzero here. In addition to the archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous vintage vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Mission Indie Possible, in our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. Relive Wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. All of this in addition to Scott Keith's Podcast of Doom, which includes discussions on questions from listeners as well as current day and old school wrestling. We also have sports covered too with the Sports Lounge, the TJ McClune Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows are available on PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the pro wrestling only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO PTBN podcast network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the reaction shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
Welcome back, Place to Be Nation pop listeners, and we pulled a little bit of a switcheroo on you this week. You see, in the last several weeks, we've been promising, as part of Walking Dead Month, a long book hunt, the episode of the Long Book Hunters, about the Walking Dead Compendium, and we promised you Jennifer Smith of the Geek and Sassy podcast would be here with us to discuss that book. Well, a little something happened along the way, and Nick and I forgot to read the book.
So it's not so much that we forgot, it's just that we just didn't. Like,
we just
I remembered, and I just didn't do it.
We just didn't do it. We were too lazy. Now, yes. So what we've done is we've decided to swap countdown of the Long Book Hunters for this month, and we will still be doing the Walking Dead Compendium. But we need a little bit more time to read it, so we're going to give ourselves till, what, next week, Nick, I think?
Yeah, and to be clear, we're not reading the entire compendium, even. We're only reading
the first two chapters, you will say. Yeah.
Yes, what essentially boils down to the first two, if you're reading it in trade paperback form, the first two volumes, the first two trades, which breaks down to, I believe, the first 12 issues, the first 12 singles of that of the run, so.
Yeah. And so joining us tonight, we still wanted her to be on our countdown of our favorite Walking Dead characters, because this is about Walking Dead characters from all different media, some from the comics, some from the video games, some from the TV show. Because Nick and I are not very familiar with the comics outside the first couple volumes of the trades, we wanted to bring in Jennifer Smith, who is a Walking Dead aficionado. Also the co-host of Geek and Sassy, which you can find right here on Place to Be Nation Pop. Jennifer, welcome back to the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
Thank you. Aficionado may be a bit of a stretch on that one, but I appreciate it.
Well, we refer to ourselves as aficionados about different things, and we really don't know anything. So it's not as much of a stretch as it usually is. So.
And, you know, more so than being an aficionado, again, we don't want to tell tales out of school before we do our official review next week, but we thought it might be good to have someone who is generally fond of the comic in on this countdown.
I am generally fond of the comic. That is true.
Right.
Very good. And so go ahead.
No, I was just going to say no spoilers, but you would be in the minority among the three of us, I believe.
I am that way most of the time.
But we are excited to have you on, and thanks for indulging us again by being on the episode. And we're hoping to create a cross section of some of the Walking Dead characters that speak to us. Now, again, folks, as we always disclaim with Countdown, these are just our personal lists. These are just our favorites. We're not purporting them to be objectively the best or anything like that, although they are, because they're on our lists. But send us your lists. If you disagree with us, send us explanations of why our lists are terrible. Send us lists of why Coral is the best character on the show. Send us
please don't. If you send us a top five that has Coral on it, I'm sending it right back to you with dog turds attached.
Send us a coral reef, if you will, and we will read it. We want to read your lists. We want to see your favorite characters in the Walking Dead universe. But let's get it started here. And I guess that as usual, I will start things off at number five, with my number five favorite character in the Walking Dead universe. And this character comes from the television side of the Walking Dead universe. This, of course, is Merle Dixon, as played by Michael Rooker. Now, Merle is a character who spent much of his time on The Walking Dead being reviled by many fans. He was a villain.
Somewhat attitudinal.
Somewhat attitudinal, some might say. Not a nice man, not a good man by any means. He was a bastard. A rat bastard, as some might say, throughout his tenure on the Walking Dead series. However, throughout his tenure on the Walking Dead, he also provided consistent entertainment, consistent laughs, and also some of the more surprisingly poignant character moments. Because without Merle, I would argue that his more popular sibling, Daryl, would not have had the character development that he had. And, you know, Michael Rooker defines this character to such a degree that Nick and I often refer to Yondu, his character in Guardians of the Galaxy, as Blue Merle. Because now, for us, for better or worse, I mean, Michael Rooker is Merle. You can't get around it. He's an iconic character. And he is
either Merle or he is Mr. Svenning from Mallrats, the father of Claire Forlani's character and the host of the cheesy dating game ripoff in the final sequence of that movie.
And lover of chocolate pretzels.
Yeah, the stink palm. The victim of the stink palm.
And also, you know, throughout the series, he had a really cool character arc. ended up with a hook hand. It was awesome. You know, just a lot of great stuff with Merle. And his last episode was genuinely great, where we got to see Merle actually do something heroic for the first time in his life. So, really cool character, really cool performance. One that I suspect may show up on one of my one of the other panelists' lists here, at least.
Well, I mean, since you mentioned, I might as well go ahead and get it out of the way. My number five character on my countdown, Merle Dixon, for all the reasons you just outlined, Greg, mainly for the comedic aspect. And, you know, you put it so well, I don't want to take up too much of the audience's time, so I'll leave you with just one little quote from old Merle, and it comes from an exchange that he has with the character of Andrea. And I'm not going where you think I'm going with a different one, Greg. An exchange he had with the character of Andrea, where he says to Andrea, "How come we never hooked up?" And she says, "You called me a whore and a rug muncher." And he says, "Got away with words, don't I?" Fantastic. Merle Dixon, everything
I'm gonna
about
hit somebody else with another Merle quote before we move on. "I almost killed the Chinese kid. He's Korean." Whatever.
So, yes.
Jennifer, you're number five?
Well, my number five is from the comic book and from one episode of the TV show. He's profane. He's perverse. He is Negan.
Oh.
He shows up in the 100th issue of the comic book, which is, and he does something so terrible that I had to stop reading the comic books for a little bit. He's just terribly, terribly wonderful. He's so funny. He has incredible scenes with Carl in the comic book. Probably the only cool part that Carl ever has, ever, is with Negan. Because, I mean, he does a slightly badass thing, and Negan is highly impressed with him. I have a quote from Negan, but it's pretty vulgar. I don't know.
We have no
We
no
frown
on
fucking vulgarity around here, Jennifer, and
do
I you do well to remind
okay. Well, you know, Negan he does what he does with Lucille, and him and Rick Rick has to just bow to his demands. You know, he has no choice. So he comes to collect his 50% after he does what he does with Lucille, and he had some words with Rick, and then he says, quote, "In case you haven't caught on, I just slid my dick down your throat and you thanked me for it."
Okay. All right. All right. Yeah. I'm good with it. So, and for those who are unaware, Jennifer, why don't you tell us a little bit about Lucille?
Lucille is Negan's number one lady, his barbed wire covered bat that he does terrible, terrible things with and breaks my heart.
And if they carry that on to the show, it's going to be quite gruesome, one might think.
It's going to be horrific, I feel like.
Now, not that I like to stir the pot or anything, but I know you're referring to a specific event from the comics that I've had spoiled for me.
Uh-huh.
Jennifer, I think you'd be interested to learn that Greg is actually hoping that happens. He is actively hoping for a certain character to be brutally murdered at the hands of Negan.
He's not my top choice, in fairness. He would be like number three or four for me.
I hope it happens too, only because it's such a gut punch, or it was for me when I read it. Like, I sobbed when I read it. So I feel like they have to do it because it is such a, like, horrific moment that really, like, hurt me really bad when I read it. So I kind of want to see it just because I think that's the way it should go.
May I offer an alternate scenario where Negan has them all kneeling down, lined up, but then he reveals that he had Carl tied up off screen the entire time and then beats Carl's brains in with the baseball bat. And he instantly becomes my favorite character since Judith, because Judith did indirectly cause Lori's death.
Oh, God.
For the record, when we went back and rewatched that pilot episode, Lori, just awful.
Oh,
I know.
Just good Lord, dude. I if we ever rewatch season two, where she literally, in the course of, like, I'm pretty sure it's either the same episode or two consecutive episodes where she goes to Rick and's like, you've got to do something about Shane. And then the next episode is like, what did you do to Shane? It's the most bewildering, frustrating characterization of any character on that show by far.
But that's for another time, Nick. That's for, dare I say, another list.
Indeed.
Well, this is exactly why we were so excited to have you on for this, Jennifer, because that's a character in Negan that Nick and I have no experience with except the one episode of The Walking Dead TV show.
Right, and a little bit – I mean, like, he's become very popular online, so there's a lot of memes and stuff that get posted and a lot of images of him. So I'm – you know, I'm vaguely familiar about what he does. Like, I know he's very vulgar and very over the top and – you know, has a penchant for violence, as it were, but I don't really know much else about him, so I'm very much intrigued to learn more about him in the new season, and I think I love Jeffrey Dean Morgan and just about everything I've ever seen him in, so great casting choice. And from what I understand, they have a plan to release season 7 on Blu-ray in an unedited version that will be more comics accurate in terms of the dialogue. I think I read that somewhere, so
very cool.
That should be interesting.
I have a feeling that he is going to become your favorite, Nick. Because he is just fucking over the top in a wonderful way.
I did love the monologue to close season 7, even if I did not like the cliffhanger choice, which was frustrating to say the least.
Yes, I agree.
Very, very good. Yeah, that's great. You know, you mentioned that he's got a penchant for violence. He also has low grade narcolepsy and a penchant for buggery. that's neither here nor there. My number 4 character also comes from the television show. And this is a character who really I changed my mind on, because at first I found her to be completely useless and didn't understand why she was on the show. And then over the course really of a half a season, the back half of one season and the front half of another season, she became one of my favorite characters, one of my 5 favorite characters in the Walking Dead universe, and that is Beth Greene, played by Emily Kinney, I believe. Negativity about my list. Now, there's two things that really turned me around on Beth. When she first started out, she didn't really do anything. She was just kind of there, you know, when they were in the prison. She was kind of just I mean, it seemed like they were trying to build you remember the weird romance plot they seemed to be trying to build with her and Carl, which was kind of strange.
But well, yeah, then they swapped it to Daryl, and it got really, like, creepy and weird, and
it
was weird, man.
I really liked it. Like, I'll be honest with you. That was when she actually won me over.
Note to self, keep Greg away from my young daughters.
Oh, for God's sake. Emily Kinney's in her mid-20s. Anyway. So, not that I've looked her up ever, but the character really turned around then. When she went off on her own with Daryl, she started to grow a personality and be a character beyond just Herschel's daughter, which was her only role in the first part of the show, was she's Herschel's daughter. And for some reason, they portrayed her like she was much younger than she was, until she wasn't. And then, of course, there was that awesome first half of – and forgive me because I can't remember the season number that this was. Season 5 maybe? The first half of it where she's in the hospital. She's been taken captive basically by these people at this hospital. And the entire – you know, there's several episodes in the first half of that season that are built around the quest for Beth, but also the fact that Beth really doesn't need saving. Beth's pretty much got her shit handled, and – I really loved how they showed her becoming an independent, strong person who, quite honestly, was more well-adjusted and capable than a lot of the people on the cast that have been there since day one. So for me, Beth grew in my eyes to the point where her death to still to this day is the death on the TV show that affected me the most, because I felt she was just getting started as a character. When they killed her, I was actually legitimately upset because I wanted to see where things went from there, because I thought she had finally developed into a character that you could really do interesting story arcs with. And right when she got to that point, they killed her. And it really was a gut punch for me in a way that some of the other deaths have not been. So Beth is my choice, controversial though she may be.
Awesome.
No reaction, no response.
I will say that I don't have any negative feelings towards Beth, but like, she was so useless and pointless for so long that like, I guess they kind of started to make me somewhat care about her by the end, but I did not have the emotional gut punch reaction to her death that you did, Greg. And
nor did I.
Is all that's the best I can. I will say
the stuff in the hospital was her best stuff. That was all right, but I might have cheered when she got shot.
No, one episode with Daryl in the abandoned house.
Yeah,
that was pretty good.
Okay. Yeah, that was
creepy as it may have been. Still
it was
pretty
not
good.
Creepy. But here's the other thing. You should have had both of you should have had an emotional gut punch, because if she had never been killed off of Arrow, she never would have played that stupid Bumblebee character on The Flash and Arrow.
Well,
that's a good point. I can't disagree with the fact that her death indirectly gave us the Bug-Eyed Bandit, so not good.
Yeah, Bug-Eyed Bandit. I can't believe that's actually the character's name. Anyway, so that was my number four. Nick?
My number four, the back end of my list is where I decided to load up on the comedic value, Greg, and with that in mind, Greg knows that I have a certain affinity for a certain fella there on The Walking Dead who likes his hair cut a certain way. And he'll tell you, I won't lie, I liked it. I may very well miss it. The feeling of the billowy curtain catching the breeze some days was straight up bliss. But brass tacks, the hair doesn't make the man. The man makes the man. And that man is Dr. Eugene Porter. I love this character on the show. He is, I have told Greg before, and I'll stand by this. At this point, you can literally kill off every character but Daryl and Eugene and have them drive around the country getting into wacky hijink adventures, going on a buddy cop show in the Walking Dead universe, and I would be fine with that. That would be the best version of the show at this point. So, Dr. Eugene Porter, for all his amazing, awkward deliveries of lines, his ability to find himself in every bizarre social situation known to man, his somewhat unique tendency to watch Abraham have sex with Rosita, I love everything about this character. I understand that a lot of people are frustrated by him and his blatant stringing along of the group, but you know what? He's made up for it. He has redeemed himself in my eyes just for the sheer entertainment value he brings to the show. So yeah, Dr. Eugene Porter is my number four.
I just find it really upsetting that we never got a meeting between Eugene and Herschel. I feel like that would have been special. Listen to yourself. You need to talk to your boy. Well, sir, I don't have a boy. Look at the pasture, Rick. That could have been an entire season.
It was an entire season.
It was.
Look at the pasture, Rick was an entire season.
I meant with Eugene in place of Rick, but
as we said last week, Greg, you have to remember, you and I both actually like season two. So.
We do, even with all the pasture staring.
Even with all the pasture staring and the Lori inconsistencies, we still like season two.
Well, season two had the amazing barn fire at the end. It was kind of worth it.
The barn fire was great, and it had the first instance of Carl getting shot and inexplicably surviving.
Right.
And it had the birth of the current version of Rick, who just says things that don't really mean anything, where you'd have Herschel take Rick out and give him this long, winding story, and Rick just kind of look at him like, what does that even mean? And then Herschel would be like, just think about it, Rick. You'll figure it out. In any event, No, that's very good. Eugene is awesome. I'm a big fan of Eugene myself. His from the first time I saw him staring at you, at Abraham and Rosita having sex and admitting to it instantly was he won himself over to me. And who can really blame anyone for watching those two get it on, right?
Yeah, I'd totally watch that.
Yeah, I mean Rosita is not on my list, but she's on a list.
She's on another list.
She's on a she's on a different list.
Yes. Jennifer, you're number four.
My number four is a character that I feel like has a really good story in the comic book and the TV show, and that's Michonne. She's very similar. They kind of keep her true to her character from the comic book in the show. They change her backstory a little bit. But, you know, when she shows up, I think early or the end of season two, beginning of season three.
Yeah, it's the closing shot of season two is her showing up and unfortunately saving Andrea for another season.
But she has, you know, she has her zombie bodyguards on chains, and you know, she just has her katana. She's just badass. I mean, from head to toe, she's calm and collected. She is, you know, she has her shit together for the most part. I mean, in the beginning, she talks to people who aren't there as a coping mechanism, but you know, she works through her traumas. She emerges as a leader. She has this incredible relationship with Rick and Carl, which, you know, that is one thing that I do like about Carl is his relationship with Michonne. And, you know, she goes through horrible things in the comic book with the governor. In the show, they don't really do that, but in the comic book, you know, he does assault her, and she exacts her revenge on him brutally. It's fantastic. I gotta say, I would do the exact same thing if I were her. And she also gets the most booty in the ZA. She sleeps with everybody pretty much in the comic book. So, you know, she's badass, and you know, she gets laid. So,
and she has.
So are you on the Michonne bandwagon?
Oh, hills, yeah, yeah, yep. Come on,
Nick has been a vocal opponent of Michonne. I actually have no issues with it. I'm fine with it. I think it's
was inevitable. It had to happen.
Well, yeah, they basically – she is filling – correct me if I'm wrong, Jennifer. It seems that she is filling somewhat of the role that Andrea played in the comics. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, that is correct. But way better, though.
Yeah. I mean, there was no way they could have taken the TV version of Andrea and transitioned it into that manner of
– yeah, she was too far gone. I mean, it was finally – she had to go when she did because they had – they had made that character so unlikable by the time she finally died that redeeming her would have been a tough task for anyone.
And I'll also say that Michonne had one of the better episodes of recent years. Well, it may not have been recent years at this point. It may have been longer ago than I remember. But the episode where they kind of revealed her backstory and what happened to her family was really, really good.
And she also, you know, she brings the you know, some color to the show. I mean, it's a pretty white show.
It is, absolutely. Nick and I have often joked about how it seems like there's a rule that they can only have two African-American characters at a given time on The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
Right. So, because, I mean, pretty much when they introduce a new one, you know one of them has to die. Like T-Dog bit it early in season two.
The lady
The
lady whose name I can't remember at the CDC. In season one.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, the old lady. Yeah. The old lady who chose to die when the CDC exploded. Tyrese had to go. You mean Derek Wallace, sir. He's always going to be Derek Wallace to me. Derek Wallace. His name is Derek Wallace, and it will always be Derek Wallace.
But, you know, she's one of the few characters who can actually get through to Rick. when he's being insane, which is
pretty
fairly
often,
you know.
Pretty often, yeah.
And she just calls him out on the shit most of the time, or just hits him and shuts him up.
So is their relationship a thing in the comics, or is that an invention of the television?
No, not that I've read. They have a close relationship, but it's not. They're not banging.
Yeah, he's with injury in the comics.
Yeah, still, as far as I know.
Interesting.
Well, we're very good. Michonne certainly adds that. And I'm a sucker for Michonne because I'm a sucker for fight scenes, and she leads to some pretty cool fight scenes.
She does.
My number three character comes from the Walking Dead video game by Telltale Studios. This is a game that Nick and I have praised repeatedly on the show. If you haven't played it, anybody out there listening, Jennifer, I don't know if you've played it.
I haven't.
It is exceptional, and I will.
It's amazing.
I will not spoil plot points for you, but it's. I would recommend. It's very. You can get it pretty cheap now. I would recommend buying season one and playing it. It's really, really good. Really, and
what's great about it for those of you out there who aren't video game aficionados, it's exceedingly easy to play. Yeah. It's essentially an animated. Yeah. An animated movie that it's like a choose your own adventure animated movie is the best way I can put it.
So good.
It's awesome.
Yeah. And takes place in the world of the comics. Like occasionally you see Herschel pop up from the comics. I mean, you see Glenn pop up.
Glenn. Yeah.
And apparently they just did a Michonne, mini
spin-off.
Season. Yeah. That I haven't played yet. Yeah. That I'm planning on playing at some point, but yeah. So
yeah, three episodes.
The character that I'm going with is the main character of season one, Lee Everett. Lee is a convict, actually. He's on his way to prison when the world falls apart, basically. The outbreak has already started, it's spread, and he's on a bus being transported in chains when it all goes to shit. And so you take the role of Lee Everett from pretty much the beginning of the outbreak through the entirety of season one. And along the way, you become the protector of a character named Clementine, who is a little girl whose parents have gone off and left her, basically. Not intentionally. They were away on vacation.
They were on vacation when the outbreak happened.
And you kind of assume protectorship of Clementine in the meantime, and it turns into this amazing road trip about this reluctant convict who takes on this fatherly role to this little girl and tries everything in his power to protect her from this horrifying environment. And they go on a road trip, essentially, trying to find a safe haven. And along the way, you meet all these other great characters. But Lee is the heart, the linchpin of the story. And you are Lee. You make the decisions for Lee. But the character of Lee grows throughout the course of that season to a degree that every decision that you make starts to torture you, starts to make you second guess yourself, to the point where by the third or fourth episode, I was actively having to pause the game because I was like, you know, what's going to happen next? What did my last decision do? What have I done? What am I leading to with this? And it's just a testament to the writing of the game, a testament to the voice acting for Lee, but also a testament to the creativity that went into this game, that they created a character like Lee Everett, who on the surface would be unlikable because this is a guy who is a killer. He's done bad things, but they position him as the hero of this story, and it really works. And I for one, have no hesitation of putting him in my top five. He's a great character.
I'll piggyback on there, Greg, because my number three is also Lee Everett. You know, for all the reasons you just said, and I will say that speaking specifically about the relationship he develops with Clementine, as they slowly reveal to you what the details of Lee's backstory are and what exactly caused him to be heading to prison that day, you begin to understand just why Clementine is so important to him and why he has taken on that responsibility, even though she's not his actual daughter. And, you know, I don't want to get into those reasons for people who haven't played the game. I'm hoping Jennifer in particular will get to play it at some point, because it really is one of the best things related to The Walking Dead I've ever encountered. Season 1 is just a tour de force, and Season 2 is damn good as well. So,
yep.
Lee Everett, for all the reasons you just mentioned, and I will say that, you know, you grow to love Lee so much over the course of those 5 episodes. You know, the ending is heart-wrenching, and his appearance in Season 2 almost made me well up when it happened, the way it was handled, his return. So,
yeah. Me too.
Absolutely love everything about that Lee Everett character. Just a great addition to the Walking Dead universe, and one that I would hope at some point they find a way to bring onto the show, he and Clementine both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jenny, you'll love this game if you play it. I don't see any way you wouldn't love it.
I kind of want to play it now. If I can get my son off the Xbox in there.
Well, what's great about this one is it's also available for Google Play Store. It's available through the Apple App Store. You can get it on your smartphone, your tablet. You can get it pretty much through any device now.
Oh, okay.
Cool. I think for laptops, too, through Steam. So pretty much any way that you can think of to play the game, they've got it. They've got that platform out there.
Cool. All right. Well, my number 3 is kind of the same situation as Michonne. This character in the comic book and the TV show have you know, they're very similar. They don't change very much with him. But it's Glenn. And, you know, I think Glenn is one of those characters that pretty much everybody likes. I mean, if you talk about The Walking Dead, you know, you get the Laurie jokes and the Shane jokes. But for the most part, I think Glenn is fairly universally loved, and for good reason.
Greg, is that accurate?
He was, you know, I loved him for a long time. They lost me on the season
the
when
dumpster?
He and Maggie. The dumpster scene, with, I don't blame him for that. I blame the show for that. But the dumpster was kind of the culmination of it. But the season where he and Maggie were apart from each other and they spent the whole time trying to get back to each other, they lost me with that because, like, to the point where, like, I think the episode that really drove me over the edge was he beats the ever-loving daylights out of Abraham, which to that, Glenn, the whole appeal to me of Glenn is that he was the everyman character. He was just a normal guy and who, more so than Rick, he was a normal guy who was the voice of the audience, kind of. And you're asking me to believe that he's going to kick the ass of a military-trained guy who's like twice his size? That was just hokey, and they turned it into too much of a, that was the only thing that was driving him was he had to get back to Maggie, and it felt heavy-handed for me, but I do agree with you. Other than that, Glenn has been awesome on the show and in the comics. I remember in the comics, he was my favorite character, actually, in the first 2 volumes.
Well, he's, you know, incredibly resourceful. You know, he saves Rick's ass right in the beginning, and, you know, he turns into a leader. People trust him. People follow him. He stays relatively, you know, level-headed and, you know, calm. He doesn't fly off the handle as much. And, you know, the romantic in me bought into the, you know, their searching for each other scenario. Can't really blame a guy, but whatever.
Oh, sure. No, I get it. I understood. I just didn't. I guess I didn't think the show handled it very well, I guess I would say. But the actors were fine, and the story itself is fine. It's just, there's only so much when every conversation turns to, but what about Glenn? I was like, you know, all right. There's other stuff going on, guys. You're about to get killed and gunned down by machine guns.
Well, that season was difficult, too, because everybody was separated and you had to follow them around. You know, you had to eventually put them all together.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Oh, very, very true. But yeah, I mean, he's like the, you know, when you first see Glenn, he pops up as kind of like, he saves Rick's ass for the first of what would be many times.
Yes.
And
yes.
He's kind of the, like I said, the everyman character. He's kind of this nerdy kind of guy who just happens to know how to survive in the zombie apocalypse. So ends up being a really cool character.
And then, you know, in episode one or in issue 100, you know, my heart gets broken, and it's because of him.
I did love the episode of the show where he and Maggie have sex for the first time in the pharmacy. If you guys remember that,
I do.
That was a great scene. Just hilarious. Like, not at all what I was expecting, because I kind of figured they would take that relationship in a ultra romantic direction, mm-hmm. and it was kind of just very animalistic at first.
Yeah.
Basic physical needs being serviced, and I appreciated that take on it.
Maggie really takes the assertive role in that one too.
And, you know, I was actually reading that that part today in the comic book, because it happened in the, I think it happened in the prison the first time. And, you know, it was similar in feel to the TV show, just different setting, but still pretty funny and entertaining.
Well, from prison sex to an innocent little girl. My number two character. My number two character on the countdown of the greatest Walking Dead characters is Clementine, who has no last name that's been revealed. Her name is just Clementine. She is from The Walking Dead seasons 1 and 2. I think that there was a very strong argument for her to get the top spot on my list, but I couldn't quite put her there. But she's certainly deserving of the honor, because you literally get to see her grow and age over the course of this game. Between seasons 1 and 2, you get to see her, you know, from a very, very young, innocent little girl, and you get to see how a little girl grows up in an apocalypse, grows up in a world where her family is gone, where her friends die, where her anyone she meets could betray her at any moment to save their own skin. It's an amazing character, and I apologize. I don't know the name of the woman who voices Clementine, but she does such an amazing job of capturing the little girl's voice, but then maturing it in season 2 and transitioning it from the naivety of the first season to a more biting sarcasm in the second season. Clementine is a character who... in season 1, you look at her as someone that you need to protect. In season 2, you feel like you're in her shoes, and you do whatever it takes to make the decisions that you think are necessary to keep her alive and to keep her safe. And over the course of those 2 seasons, it kind of makes you realize that she's got something that some of the characters on the show don't have, and that's she's well-rounded. She's not in one state of mind all the time. She's got complexities. She gets angry. She gets sad. She gets happy. But she manages to stay a well-balanced person who is surrounded by completely unbalanced people, from her interesting friend Kenny to pretty much anyone she meets along the way. They all have adapted to this situation in many ways worse than she has, which is interesting since they're grown-ups by and large. So Clementine is my number two character on the list.
I will withhold comment about Clementine for now, you know, not to give too much away, but I'll move on to my number two. And this is one that I think I know will pop up on Greg's list here in a minute as well. I'm going with Daryl Dixon at the number two spot. I mean, at this point, it's almost cliche to sit here and say that you watch The Walking Dead and that you love Daryl Dixon, but I do. I mean, he is the best character on the show for so many reasons. I would argue he is the character on the show who has been allowed to grow while also retaining some semblance of the guy he originally was. His characterization, for the most part, while it has fluctuated here and there, and while the writers have kind of lost track of it, you know, in recent seasons, like they have lost track of many characters, I would argue he's still the most consistently written character. He's still the most consistently fascinating character. He is a guy, and Norman Reedus's portrayal of him just brings such a hint of true emotional trauma. We've never really been told what all has happened to this guy in his life, but you get the idea that he has really been through a lot, and that has really, shaped the way he views people and the way he interacts with people. And it's so great to see that character journey from season one, where he is just as much of a hothead and just as much of a jerk as Merle is. And essentially, once he gets away from Merle, you see that character it's implied for the first time in his life, get to grow and become his own person. And that's just such a wonderful journey over the course of this show. And I mean, it's cliche, but I'll say it now. If they make the stupid-ass decision to kill him off, that is my Jerry Seinfeld putting his hands up and walking out of the theater moment.
Did your house just burn down, Nick?
Sadly, no. It's still here. No, it's still here.
Your patented malfunctioning fire alarm?
Yes, it's my malfunctioning fire alarm that somehow doesn't wake any of my children up that I'll never comprehend. But anyway, Daryl Dixon, fantastic character. Norman Reedus does a great job. And they just give him so many great... I mean, like, it's almost like the writers at this point just are specifically saving all the best scenes and all the best lines for Daryl. I mean, he really does have, standout moment after standout moment. So... I'm hoping that, the big story of season 7 is him getting to kick the ever living shit out of that guy who stole his crossbow.
Yeah.
That's the moment I want to see, not him getting beaten, his brains beaten in with a baseball bat.
He needs his Eddie Murphy, he didn't get my cornbread moment.
I don't think it's going to be him, honestly. I don't think they're going to kill him.
It better not be. It would be an insanely stupid. I mean, like, because you would be going and taking so you've already pissed everybody off with the cliffhanger, first of all. And then if you come back from the cliffhanger and kill off everyone's favorite character, I worry for the fan backlash that will ensue.
Agreed.
Or for the fan no mercy, for that matter. There's a little wrestling joke for you out there. I'm going to withhold comment for now. But Jenny, what about you? What's your number two character?
Well, I feel like I'm going to catch a lot of shit from you guys about this one, but whatever, I don't care. My number two is Rick.
You'll catch more shit from Greg than you will from me.
I understand, but he's the main character. He's the one that got it started. You followed him from the beginning. How can he not be on the top five list? And Andrew Lincoln does incredible work on that show.
He really does, yeah.
He's been through so much, and they all have, but Rick was the character that I was first invested with, and it has stuck around. I mean, he screwed up. He's done crazy things. He wildly changes his mind and, his philosophies about life just at random. But
he farms for 6-month periods at times.
I mean, I can't say that I blame the guy. I mean, it's the fucking zombie apocalypse. And it's not that unbelievable that this is how it's turned out. I mean, he is a product of what he's gone through. Some people can rise above and some people can't. But he's still, I feel like his breaking point, like his real turnaround moment, was when he ripped that guy's jugular out with his teeth for trying to assault Carl.
Yeah, and, the biker gang or whatever.
Yeah, the claimers or whatever they were. And he had gone off the rails before, but that was just like the end. Like that was he was, and I'm a parent, and I would do that. Straight up, I would do that. I feel like this season Negan needs to cut his arm off. The arm needs to come off. And I would like to see him, like in the comic books, initially he has to go along with what Negan wants from him, and then he has a plan, Greg. He comes up with a plan.
The plan's good. The plan's solid. It's going to work.
And, you know, it's not bad, but he has help. He has some maybe more thoughtful people that are helping with the plan, and maybe it works.
My memory of last season is that his plan for dealing with the herd was essentially like the zombie apocalypse version of the board game Mousetrap, where it took so many different stupid contraptions that you had to set up and hope that all the timing was just perfect and that one thing wasn't like a fraction of an inch off for the stupid mousetrap to catch the stupid little plastic
knife.
I'm pretty sure that's what it was.
He appeared to have no plan for Daryl and Sasha to actually get back to the to the place. It's like, all right, you're going to drive for about 50 miles and lead the horde away. All right,
you know,
then what?
It was kind of like my, it's kind of like my son, my 7-year-old, coming up with plans. You know, just like none of it made any sense. Like, but nobody said anything. Like, nobody stood up. Like, they just went with it.
The best part, there was like, if you remember, there was that one guy who was like the, I don't know if he was a painter or what he was, that one guy that was part of the city that was like, I don't know, like I have some real reservations about this plan. And then like Carol or somebody stood up and goes, the plan's good, but the plan will work. And I'm like, no, aren't you going to listen to the guy? I think he's got some good observations I'd like to bring up. And then you just shout at them.
While I agree with Greg that Rick's plans are often ill-conceived at best, I will say that I don't have a major issue with some of Rick's decisions he's made in recent seasons. I think they have done a good enough job of showing how far he's been pushed and showing why he is the way he is now. You know, it's been a believable character arc in my
opinion. I feel the same way. To me, believable. Extreme, yes, but believable.
Yeah.
And Andrew Lincoln is phenomenal. He's done a great job. He's great. I guess that brings me to my number one selection on the list, on the countdown of the Walking Dead characters. And that, of course, is the aforementioned Daryl Dixon, as played by Norman Reedus. Nick already said it perfectly, really, about pretty much everything that I could say about Daryl, why he's my favorite character. But I think to summarize it, and to me, he works as a counterpoint to Rick. Rick's a character who at the beginning was a really great and engaging character, and over the course of the show, they took him down, they broke him down to such a degree that he's no longer the good man that he once was. And maybe that's part of the story of the show, is the fact that you're showing how, you know, basically a guy who starts out as a basically genuinely good man can be warped and twisted by the events that happen to him. Contrarily, Daryl is a character who starts the show as Nick pointed out, an unlikable jerk, a guy who is really mean and really whiny and really, you know, out for himself and his brother, and that's it. And then over the course of, especially the course of the first 3-4 seasons, something happens that you don't expect, and I don't remember when I first realized that it had happened, but at a certain point, you started to recognize that Daryl was a character that was genuinely growing, and a character who, in a weird way, for everybody else, the zombie apocalypse is the worst thing that's ever happened to them. It's ruined their lives. I feel like Daryl is a character whose life was saved by the zombie apocalypse.
Yep.
I think his turning around point was maybe early the search for Sophia and how involved he became.
Yes.
In that.
That's a great point. Yep.
Specifically, the episode entitled, I believe it's Chupacabra, where he sees the vision of Merle. And he spends the entire episode hallucinating and having a conversation with Merle. And Merle is pretty much mocking him for, like, doing good and decent things. And Daryl, even though it's not actually Merle, stands up to the hallucination of Merle and basically, you know, tells him off and insists that he's going to continue to, you know, do things to help the group and protect the group. That's a big character moment for that character.
Definitely. And over the course of the show, you really you see that this zombie apocalypse, as it were, ends up transforming Daryl and allowing him to become the man that he could have been in a different scenario in life. But if it never happens, he never gets out of Merle's shadow. He never is allowed to interact with the people like Glenn, like Rick, who like Carol, who genuinely change his life for the better. And you see a character who starts out as the ultimate loner and ends up as the ultimate team player, a person who genuinely cares about the rest of the group more than he cares about himself. And it's in many ways, this is echoing the character journey of Wolverine in Chris Claremont's X-Men, which I've mentioned that before on the show, that the parallels between Daryl and Wolverine. But it's beyond just he's the cool one or he's the trendy one to like. It's Wolverine was popular for a reason, because he started out as this jerk loner character who made fun of Cyclops and made fun of all the other X-Men and was really just out for himself. And over the course of the years of being around those other people, he grew to love them. He grew genuine relationships with them and became the ultimate X-Man, became the ultimate team player, the one that was going to be there that they could count on. If all the shit hit the fan, they could count on him to be there. And that's what Daryl's become on The Walking Dead, and that's why he is my favorite character.
Very well said, Greg. Moving on to my anticlimactic number one, I am going with Clementine from The Walking Dead video game for this simple reason. Part of the appeal of The Walking Dead television show and the video game and any of the media in this universe at this point is the discussion it creates among fandom of what would you do if you were in that situation. Well, with the character of Clementine, you get to make those decisions. You get to put yourself in the shoes of someone who is living this out. You get to develop her over the course of two entire seasons, even if you don't realize you're doing it during season one at times. You get to create essentially your version of what a Walking Dead character is and should be. And it's so interesting, especially in season two, to get to play with the idea of a little girl who has either been strengthened by the zombie apocalypse or corrupted by the zombie apocalypse. Because there are moments where you can play her as borderline sociopathic in terms of her manipulation of people and her ability to get whatever she wants out of a particular situation. There's so much room there to make Clementine your own that, again, like Greg said earlier about Lee Everett, it speaks to the tremendous skill of the writers of the game that they were able to do such amazing things with this character. And as I said previously, I really, really hope that the show finds a way to bring her and Lee on at some point. They are just both amazing characters that you get to shape and you get to mold into whatever you want to be. So that may be a little bit of a cheap answer, but because you get to create her, because you get to determine this contribution to the Walking Dead universe, Clementine is my number one.
And I'm really interested in you know, exploring that and playing that game now. So
you'll love it.
It's really good. I mean, both seasons are great. I think I prefer season one. I think Greg prefers
season two.
If I remember correctly, but they're both excellent. The voice acting, the animation, everything about them is just really, really great. And what's awesome is your choices from season one actually carry over into season two, so that there is no clean slate. I mean, everything you do matters in the long run, and you can see that as you go throughout the game how what may have seemed like a minor decision earlier in the game winds up being everything later. It's a really cool approach to episodic video game storytelling, which I don't think has ever really been attempted by anyone other than Telltale.
Then who?
Telltale.
You know,
Telltale.
Video games are what my father did. I'm the episodic serial storytelling business.
There you go.
So with all that said, we're gonna cap it off with the main event. Jenny, give us your number one character in the Walking Dead universe.
My number one character is Lori. No, just kidding.
Oh my god. That,
get the fuck out.
That was going to be
epic. Get out and never come back.
I've been waiting this whole time for that joke. Okay, no, really, it's Carol.
She's great.
Okay, that's much better.
Specifically the TV version of Carol, because the comics version of Carol sucks a lot.
Okay, that's one thing I've always wondered. What is the, I mean, like, is there anything that the two share other than a name?
No. No.
Okay. Terrible. Fair enough.
Melissa McBride is a fucking jewel of an actress. She deserves all of the awards from everybody. She blows me away in every scene. I don't understand her talent. And she takes Carol from this meek, abused mother and wife, and she has just basically given her a hero's journey, in my opinion. When we meet her, she's just, you know, broken and beaten down. She loses her daughter, but she gradually gains this inner strength from the people around her, and she just turns into a legitimate badass. She's confident. She becomes confident. She becomes useful. She starts in the prison. She starts training the kids to use knives, and she develops the relationship with Lizzie and Mika, which, you know, turns out heartbreaking. I mean, it's just the
greatest episode. Yeah,
hands down. It's just, I've never seen anything like that before. And in that season where everybody was separated, and she and she was already carrying all the guilt from having killed Tyrese's Lady Karen in the prison. And Rick kicked her out, and she had yet to come clean. But then after the events of the Grove, she had to come clean to Tyrese about it. And, you know, she just completely solidified herself as this person who has just reinvented her entire way of thinking. And then in the last season, her deception in Alexandria, pretending to be this ditzy little den mother that bakes cookies and casseroles and just flawless. I mean, at the same time, she goes and steals guns and distributes them. And, you know, when the wolves attack, she just snaps back into character and starts murdering people left and right. I mean, it's just...
And bonus points for her scaring the living shit out of that annoying fucking kid.
That was amazing. No.
That kid. What?
What, Greg?
That kid was not a favorite of mine. I'll put it that way.
I'm pretty sure next year when we do our bottom five Walking Dead characters, mine will be entirely characters under the age of 18. I'm pretty sure that'll be my list. Like, just
and Lori.
And, well, you know, Lori and Duck are going to be right there.
Duck
neck and neck,
is a video
Greg,
game
I'm
character,
afraid.
By the way, Jenny. If
you're, okay.
If you're about that.
Oh, good Lord. A video game character who his own parents describe as not the brightest crayon in the box.
But
and, quote, dumber than a bag of hammers.
Kenny does say that at one point, doesn't he?
Yes,
anyway,
he does.
Yeah, no, Jenny, great choice. And we talked, Nick mentioned earlier about how Norman Reedus, when he's playing Daryl, often shows you more through his performance than the dialogue indicates. It's almost that kind of wounded child inside of him that comes out. Melissa McBride, same way. Like, she that the season that you were referring to, where she was hiding that information from Tyrese, everything that she says, everything that she does in that season, you can see how it's eating away at her, how it wears on her, even when she's delivering innocuous lines like, "Hey, we need to check out the cabin" or whatever. She's saying it in a way with her facial expressions that indicate the struggle that's going on underneath. Her acting on this show is phenomenal. I will confess, I didn't like Carol in the first few seasons. And at some point, she just took off for me and became undeniable, to the point where I now retroactively am like, oh my God, what an amazing performance.
That is
pretty much after she was brought back, what was it, early season 4 when Rick exiled her from the prison, I think. And pretty much from the moment she came back onto the show has just been like night and day, in my opinion. And that's one of the things, I do not understand the show's fascination with continuing to take her off the board for extended periods of time. I do not know why you would not want to use that character.
You have to have her on screen.
Yeah.
You know, and I hope she is back early in season 7.
She basically saves them all from Terminus. I mean, they were about to be consumed.
Yes.
And she fucking blows that up. I mean,
and thank God she one of the most satisfying kills was when she allowed the Terminus lady to be eaten at the end.
Yes.
Phenomenal.
And then, you know, at the end of the last season where her and Maggie are kidnapped and, you know, she pretends to have this breakdown and she blows me away.
And she's clenching the cross.
And again, I have to say, the Look at the Flowers episode,
the
best episode of The Walking Dead.
Yes.
The best performance in an episode of The Walking Dead. It was a performance that was so good that it literally drew tears to my eyes. It was so good. It was so impactful. It's a hard – Nick and I talked about this after we watched it. It's hard to watch in many ways, but in the best possible way.
The best way,
It's hard to watch in a good way. So that's if Walking Dead ended today – and I had to show somebody, if somebody asked me, why did you like that show, I would show them that episode.
That's the best episode in the show's history, in my opinion. I mean, it's just amazing. Like, it's everything. So good.
Well, before we wrap up, let's recap everyone's lists. I had at number 5, Merle Dixon. I had at number 4, Beth Greene. I had at number 3, Lee Everett. I had at number 2, Clementine, and I had at number 1, Daryl Dixon. Nick?
I had at number 5, Merle Dixon. Number 4, Dr. Eugene Porter. Number 3, Lee Everett. Number 2, Daryl Dixon. And number 1, Clementine.
Jennifer. And I had at number 5, Negan. Number 4, Michonne. Number 3, Glenn. Number 2, Rick. And number 1, Carol. And, if I may...
Mm-hmm.
Sidebar, an honorable mention.
Yeah, we like to do that when we have guests on.
Yeah, sure. I will say Chris Hardwick, because I mean, this show kind of made his career, you know, I feel like his fate is like tied in. Well, maybe not so much anymore, but you know, he's such an integral part of, you know, the watching experience, because it's such a social experience for me to watch his show and to discuss it with fans and to have the little therapy time with Chris afterwards. And I just really enjoy it.
I have to make a confession. I've never watched an entire episode of Talking Dead. Not once.
I enjoy it.
Not once. Usually because here on the, you know, in the Eastern time zone, like by the time it wraps up, I'm like, all right, time to hit the old sack here. So I am usually not awake.
I think I liked it more when it was shorter, when it was like 30 minutes. I haven't been able to watch it as much since haven't they expanded to an hour now?
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, I haven't been able to watch it as much there, but I like Hardwick. Hardwick does an incredible job, and he's one of the hardest working guys in entertainment, because he does Talking Dead,
everywhere.
He does The Nerdist, he does all this other stuff on the side. They even did a Talking Preacher that I meant to watch and I forgot to watch. So,
They also started doing a Better Call Saul talking show that I believe he hosted.
Did you have any characters, Jenny, that came close to making your list that just missed the cut?
You know, not really. I feel pretty confident about my list.
The only one that I wish I could have fit on there was, and I don't even know this character's name, but random Terminus resident who slits the throat of the dude who plays the Penguin on Gotham, just because it gave us an image that we'll never get to see on Gotham, unfortunately. So, you know,
he slit the throat of Gotham Kid and also put an end to the career of Good Charlotte.
Oh,
so.
God.
Yes, in one fell swoop.
I wrestled all day long with my number five spot, and of course I ended up with Merle, but I almost had Morgan on. I'm a big fan of Morgan.
Yeah.
We watched the premiere episode last week, the season one premiere, and he was great from the first episode, but he's another one of those. I'm a sucker for character journeys, and I feel like even though he hasn't been in a lot of episodes, I feel like Morgan has had one of the most interesting character journeys over the course of the series.
That episode where when we first meet him again after the pilot,
Clear,
and he's lost his son.
Clear. Yes.
Is that the name of the episode? Clear?
Favorites.
Okay, and he's like, he's borderline insane at that point because the grief has almost driven him mad, literally. That's just an amazing episode. And such a logical character direction for somebody who was already struggling with the loss of his wife. And like in the pilot, especially like we said, going back and watching it last week, there were hints of that in his performance, that his son was the only thing enabling him to keep it together. So it was a really cool direction they went with him in that episode. And then of course the more recent episodes, like I said, Greg, you know, the Jedi Morgan thing still at times bothers me, but ultimately I'm able to get over it because the performance is just so damn good. Like
that episode was somewhat controversial, but I think both of us were really high on it. Really high on it.
Was Clear controversial? No, not Clear.
I'm talking about the one where he gets trained by that guy who's been in a lot of
Eastman.
Things, but I don't know his name.
I believe the character's name was Eastman.
Yes, that's
is that
correct.
Yep. And I know him primarily because he played Arthur Lee Allen, the Zodiac Killer in
that's
Zodiac.
That's right, he did. But that episode I thought was phenomenal. I thought it was just incredibly rewarding and well acted, and for me, seeing Morgan come around and be transformed over the course of that episode from the raving lunatic into somebody who had come to peace with himself was really cool. But with all that being said, that draws us to an end of another longer than usual edition of Countdown. But this was an awesome topic to get into. Really hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you, Jenny, for joining us to count down. We're so glad that you added some elements from the comics, dropped some knowledge on us that we didn't have about Negan and several other characters, actually. So thanks so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I always think it's weird that I actually get to, like, talk back to you during this podcast because I listen to you guys all the time. So I'm like, oh, yeah, I get to talk this time.
You probably spend most of the time shouting at the whatever listening device that you have. Like, what are you guys talking about, for God's sake?
No, mostly I just laugh.
Well, that's good. There's somebody out there that enjoys it, so that's good. And
hey, I just listened to the entire draft, so there's that.
Oh, good Lord.
Your check is in the mail.
You're the brave one. Yeah.
She'll be
awarded some sort of war medal.
I'm going to make a confession. I have finally finished the draft. I'm still making my way through the pitches right now. The pitches are good. But, man, that draft took 10 years off my life, I think. But,
you know, y'all played it cool,
that was just recording
though.
It.
We played it cool.
I mean, I could tell there was some annoyance, but, you know, it wasn't like a full-on screaming match or anything, you know? I was like, that wasn't that bad.
It wouldn't have done any good to go into a full-on screaming mode at that point. As I said on the show, I just wanted it to be over at a certain point.
Oh, Lord. Anyway, folks, we are really happy that Jenny came on with us. And, Jenny, tell the folks about Geek and Sassy.
Well, Geek and Sassy is a podcast that my friend Miranda and I started, derivative as it may be. But we just like to talk about the geeky stuff that we like, and we're both moms, so we like to throw in some stuff about our kids every now and then. We're on Twitter at Geek and Sassy, so follow us.
Follow them, folks. Absolutely, they got a great show that I am actually trying to listen to the second episode. I have to finish the Pitches podcast, and that's next on my agenda after that. And
you haven't finished the second episode yet, Greg?
Jeez.
I know, sir.
I've got you in my queue, but like I said,
Are you sure it's not the third episode you're trying to work your way through?
It may be the third. All I will say is it took me a week and a half to get through the draft, I think. It felt like it anyway. Oh,
good Lord.
It's retro. Things are being brought back to my memory as I listen to the draft. What I assume are like the memories of those who have undergone trauma in their lives, but no, we got through it, and I am definitely enjoying the show. Also, always enjoy the shout outs that we get on the show on occasion.
I'm working my way through the third episode, and I will say that I'm glad that someone besides me, was able to call out Russell for his bizarre hatred of Batman 66.
It was a little bit bizarre, wasn't it?
Quite frankly, I'd suggest it was somewhat unique and nonsensical, in my opinion. But
see,
it's not
what we need
to
do is we need to have Russell on, not to debate Batman 66, but so that so you can debate him on Batman 66, and so I can debate him on Lois and Clark. Although I think he's on
I'll debate him on Lois and Clark, which I think that was more of a Kelly thing.
That's
anyway.
More Kelly, yeah.
Yes. Which I think he admitted to, but,
wait a minute. Are you a fellow Lois and Clark fan?
Hells, yeah, I am. Yes.
Oh, my God. We just became best friends.
Oh, my God. I love that man. Show.
Yeah, so good. Terry Hatcher was the best. Shut up, Nick. Anyway.
I didn't say anything. I didn't say one word, Greg.
What do we have coming people's way the next few weeks, Nick?
Next two episodes, we're going to finish up Walking Dead month. As you said, we had to move some things around, but next week is our long book hunt, a review of The Walking Dead volumes 1 and 2. And then, at the end of the month, we've got our full length, a very special episode with our full length review of the season 7 premiere. We'll hopefully finally get some questions answered from the season 6, cliffhanger. So, that's coming up in the next couple weeks, and then back in November, we'll be back on our normal schedule where we'll have a little bit of, let's see, we're going off the page. Do you remember what we went off the page with? Because I don't.
November? Yeah. Oh, I do, actually. We're going to be reviewing.
Yeah, I do. I do, actually, as well.
Well, that's our hard
no,
travel.
No.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right.
Our off the page, yes, is actually going to be about a card game, of all things. Right?
No, it's no? not. No. I got you here. Our off the page next month, in honor of the release of Doctor Strange.
Oh.
What a lot of people may not realize, this is not the first Doctor Strange movie. There was actually an animated movie that came out about 10 years ago, I think. And so we're going to be going and taking a look back at the direct-to-DVD Doctor Strange animated feature that Marvel produced.
Wow.
So we're going to be looking at that. We're also going to be looking at, as Jennifer mentioned, in Hard Travelers for Hire, our next installment with we're going to be focusing on The Incredible Hulk, and Russell Sellers of the Sellers Point podcast will be joining us for that one. We've got a countdown with Marvel big wig, some official title that we can never remember. He's a big freaking deal. Ben Morse is going to be counting down the top 5 Marvel video games of all time with us. And then, of course, that's it. Yeah, that's our November.
Absolutely. So, you mentioned
got a lot going on.
And you mentioned our review of the season premiere of The Walking Dead will be a very special episode. Another show that had very special episodes, Family Matters. See, we tie that into last week's podcast. So who knows? You never know when Reginald Vell Johnson might guest star one week on the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
Do you have a Reginald Vell Johnson
impression?
Please
tell me you do.
I have toyed around with one. I'll just put it that way. I haven't yet.
Oh, now wait just a minute. You can't be a
the only thing I have. Right? The only thing I have. The only Vell Johnson impression that I have is him saying, "Harriet." Oh,
I know where it's going. Go. Harriet. There we go.
Just picture he walks down the staircase and he folds his arm and he tilts his head to the side and he smiles and he says, "Harriet."
And he,
Steve!
He tips his little police hat.
Police hat, yes. And we, with that being said... anyway, with all that being said, we've come to the end, mercifully, of our Traveling Fanboys. And we hope you've enjoyed us. Thanks again to Jennifer Smith for joining us. As always, we hope you tune in next week. Be sure to listen to Geek and Sassy, and be sure to listen to all the other great podcasts here at Place to Be Nation Pop. We'll catch you next week for the Long Book Hunters, we promise.
Dime store watch and a ring made from a spoon. Everyone's looking for someone to blame, and you share my bed, you share my name. Well, go ahead, call the cops. You don't meet nice girls in coffee shops. She said, baby, I still love you. Sometimes there's nothing left to do. Oh, but you got to hold on, hold on. Baby, gotta hold on and take my hand. Standing right here, you gotta hold on. Well, God bless your crooked little heart. St. Louis got the best of me. I miss your broken China voice. How I wish you were still here with me. Oh, you build it up, you wreck it down. Then you burn your mansion too. Nothing left to keep you here. But when you're falling behind and it's a big blue world, oh, you've got to hold on, hold on. Baby, gotta hold on, take my hand. Standing right here, gotta hold on. Down by the Riverside Motel, it's thin below and falling. By a 99-cent store, she closed her eyes and started swaying. But it's so hard to dance that way when it's cold and there's no music. Oh, you're hometown so far away, but inside your head there's a record that's playing, a song called Hold On, Hold On. Baby, gotta hold on to take a mind. Standing right there, gotta hold on. You gotta hold on, hold on. Baby, gotta hold on. Standing right there, you gotta hold on. You gotta hold on, hold on. Baby, gotta hold on and take a mind. Standing right here, you gotta hold on. You gotta hold on, hold on. Baby, gotta hold on and take a mind. Standing right here, you gotta hold on. 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 You gotta hold on.